America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, looky, everybody. It's Monday. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, but you can get the streams not only there, but at the usual source, WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can get the streams at iTunes Radio. You can get the streams at Stitcher Radio. You can get the streams at TuneIn Radio and Tuner Internet Radio. My goodness gracious, there are places all over the series of tubes where you can get the Head On Radio Network stream, and I invite you to try any one you wish or any number you wish just to find which one suits your needs best. I've found on various incarnations of mobile phones, Tuner Internet Radio and TuneIn Radio seem to be my best bets, as well as Stitcher. It's always reliable as well. So, wow, just forging boldly into the future. That's what we're doing here. This is The Horn. We call what we do here Conversation Radio. And you'll find out why in fairly short order. So, hang in, sit back, hang out, talk to the speakers, work on dinner, whatever, build a model airplane or a ship in a bottle. I don't care, as long as you're there and as long as you share your thoughts, your ideas, and your conversation, either by email or by the phone or by the chat room. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom is a great place to hang out for the next 3 hours. You'll find it a quite merry and enjoyable crowd there, without a doubt. And that's free. It's free. Or, you know, if it suits you, just stand outside and scream at the heavens. Some of it may just wash back at us. One never knows. If you will take a gander, now that we are on, it's the 9th of April, take a gander over to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, right there on the main page. You will find that via the handy-dandy graphic widget hickey thing that John Fox put up, right above the PayPal button, you'll see that we have cleared $580 for the month. And so that leaves us $45 short as of the 7th day of April, and this week we've got to bring in another $625, so any hope, any help, maybe that was a Freudian slip, any help you can give will be much, much appreciated. Now, tonight, you know already that we don't do a lot of guests on this program. Oh, by the way, Isaac pointing out also free internet radio via Shoutcast Radio. You can, no. I can't submit our station to them, our network to them, Isaac, because they only work on Shoutcast, and we are an IceCast. We're an IceCast production. IceCast is, if I understand, let's see if I can put this correctly. IceCast is open sourced, whereas Shoutcast, you pay literally by the minute. And in light of the previous fundraising note, if we had to do that, we'd probably wind up being off the air. To get back to what I was saying, I mentioned this on Friday, and we confirmed this over the weekend. And I am very, very pleased that we're going to be joined in a matter of a few minutes by the author of both 1491 and 1493, Mr. Charles C. Mann. If you've been listening for about the last 2 months, you've heard me speak glowingly. Well, you've heard me for years speak glowingly of 1491. I'd say if we compiled a top 10 list of relevant books, at least for us here, the Horn, 1491 would be high on that list, as is 1493. Basically, in 1493, what you're going to find out is that 200 million or so years ago, or to the fundamentalists, two weeks ago, about 2:16 on a Thursday, what had been a single continent on this planet separated into a number of little different pieces and began developing and evolving entirely separately. Now, that's where you get to the 1491 versus 1493 dichotomy. It is after the arrival of Christopher Columbus, or any of his other varied names, in the autumn of 1492 in what became known as the West Indies, that divergence that happened 200 million years before began closing. And it is what has been documented both in the previous magnificent work, 1491, and the present magnificent work, 1493, is the summary of effects. There's a tendency to say, well, this is fascinating history, but it's not history. This is fascinating ecology, but it's not all ecology. Oh, look at the anthropology. No, it's not that either. It's everything. It's the kind of book that the moment you set it down, your eyes sort of spin. If you're reading it on a Kindle or some other e-reader, you find yourself highlighting to come back again and again and again. And I know several of you have already purchased the book, and I'm glad, because I think it will we'll have our little book club corner here. For instance, I got an email from our good friend Mike, and he wrote in and said, after hearing you talk about Charles C. Mann's books so much over the last few weeks, I purchased 1491 for my Kindle. Holy cow! I knew some of this history, but not enough. I forget if I've mentioned this to you before, but before getting into psychology, I majored in history in college. I graduated with a dual BA in psych and history. I attended a very small, very conservative Christian college. I never fit in. Long story as to how I got there, but it had to do with a high school girlfriend who wanted to attend there, and I applied there too because I wanted to be with her. I got in, and she didn't. Oops. End of that relationship. I ended up meeting some wonderful people, most of whom didn't really fit in either, and I still count them among my closest friends. But the ultra-conservative atmosphere always bugged me. Anyway, Bob, on the last day of the first semester of my freshman year, the professor in my World History 101 class asked us if there was any part of world history we felt he hadn't covered sufficiently. I raised my hand and said that I would have liked to learn more about the history of the Western Hemisphere prior to Columbus. I still remember his reaction and that of the rest of the class. I remembered it to this day. It was the first time I'd ever really been humiliated in a classroom. I barely had the sentence out of my mouth before he started laughing and said, "There wasn't any!" I swear to you, Bob, the whole class laughed for about a minute. I never took a class with him again. Anyway, thanks for yet another good book recommendation. I hope you have had a happy holiday, and I hope you did as well, Mike. We had a lovely holiday here. The barbecue that we talked about on Friday with Brother Albert was magnificent. Hot and spicy slaw to go with it. Yeah, good eats all the way around on a lovely, lovely Easter Sunday. So without further ado, let's go to the phones, where I do believe Mr. Mann is standing by, and enough shilly-shallying for me. Let's hear from him about his tremendous, tremendous work. Are you with us, Mr. Mann?
Yes, I am. Thank you for the kind words.
Oh, thank you for joining us. This is like a conversation with a rock star to me, so forgive me, but The work that you have done in pulling both of these books together is tremendous, and as I explained some time back and noted in my email to you, when I tried to get you on the air for 1491, you said, I'd be happy to, but I'm in China, and I thought, what's he doing in China? Now I know. Obviously, you were researching a significant portion of 1493. Let's start, if you don't mind. Well, we'll have to talk a little bit about 1491 as well, I think. But let's start with the new word I learned when I opened 1493, the homogenocene. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, that's a term that some biologists use to describe the period after Columbus. And what they mean is, kind of like you were saying at the beginning of the show, that, you know, for a couple hundred million years, the continents were completely separate. And as a result, they ended up with completely different suites of, of plants and animals. And what Columbus did, you know, the reason he's important if you're a biologist, is he recreated Pangaea, the original continent. He brought together the various separate pieces of the world and created this ecological convulsion in which huge numbers of creatures from over there came over here, and huge numbers of creatures from over here went over there. And this enormous explosion is the homogenocene, is the time when all the world's different ecosystems were homogenized. And that's what it refers to, this great process of homogenization that's slowly taking place and is still occurring today.
And it really was a Pandora's box that cannot be closed, wasn't it? Because not only you catalog very well what the effect has been of the migration of both flora and fauna, but there's really it's really hard to understand what was lost and what was replaced. Is there any way of putting that into words? I mean, what the New World looked like before Columbus, or imagining an Italy without a tomato, or a Germany or an Ireland without a potato, or even an Afghanistan without the pumpkin?
Well, there's it really is hard to imagine. I mean, here I live in Western New England, it's really amazing to me to consider what I would be eating now if I could only eat things that originated in Western New England. My diet would be pretty different from what it is now. If you think about it, in this part of the hemp world, in the Americas, as a result of events that took place about 15,000 years ago that we don't really understand, there are very, very few domesticable animals. So there are no cattle, there are no horses, there are no sheep, there are no goats, there's no poultry. There's none of the familiar domestic animals that we know of today. And so, people who lived here lived, without all of those kinds of animals. Similarly, if you go over to Europe, they didn't have, some estimates are two-thirds of the kinds of fruits and vegetables that they eat today. They didn't, they had wheat and barley, but they didn't have potatoes. They didn't have any kind of peppers. They didn't have squash. They didn't have tomatoes. I mean, the list goes on and on. And that's just foods. Then, one of the biggest changes was that there's completely different disease environments on the different parts of the world. Because there are domesticated animals in Europe and Asia and Africa, and there weren't in the Americas had very few of what are called zoonotic diseases. And that's a sort of a $3 word, meaning an animal disease that jumps the species barrier, as scientists say, and becomes a human disease. And most of the great killers in human history are that kind of disease, where people living close to farm animals caught a mutated version of a farm disease, and then it spread through the air. And so smallpox, influenza, measles, all of them are mutated animal diseases. And the result, and the first thing that happened for the Columbian Exchange, and one of the greatest events, was that when Europeans came across the Atlantic, they inadvertently brought over these huge numbers of diseases with them. And whereas Europeans had been swimming in this kind of bacterial and viral soup for thousands and thousands of years, people in this part of the world hadn't, and the results were catastrophic when that bacterial and viral soup were introduced. And in the first 150 years or so after Columbus, somewhere between two-thirds and 90% of the original inhabitants of the Americas died. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in human history, and it goes a long way to explaining why small groups of Europeans, poorly supplied Europeans, poorly equipped Europeans, at the end of very long supply chains, were able to prosper in environments that were completely unlike anything they had seen before.
But they were not unscathed either. You go to great detail to describe the various vectors by which malaria and yellow fever entered the New World. And that didn't just affect the native population. It was certainly hard on the white folks too, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's this broad band of the Americas, roughly speaking, from Chesapeake Bay, you know, Washington D.C., all the way down across the equator to southern Brazil, where particularly virulent forms of malaria and yellow fever became common. They're introduced from various parts of Europe and Asia and Africa, and it became very difficult for Europeans to survive, and this played a huge role in the development of the slave trade, because Africans, people from Central and West Africa, are more immune to malaria than yellow fever for genetic reasons than any other people on the planet. And it became quickly apparent, this was all shown first by a historian, a wonderful historian named Philip Curtin, and what it became clear was, if you were a plantation owner in Virginia or Carolina or Brazil or Haiti, what you wanted was labor, and if you brought over indentured servants from Europe, they would be very likely to die, whereas if you brought over Africans, they would be much more likely to survive. And even though Africans were poor workers because they were slaves and they hated you, it was much better to have a poor worker that hated you than a dead worker.
But even among those African slave colonies, it's not quite the story that we have typically been given to understand. Tell folks a little bit about the rise of the maroon colonies in Central America, Brazil, and the impact that they had on cultural development, please.
Yeah. Well, in the first couple centuries after Columbus, many more Africans came to the Americas than Europeans. In fact, as late as 1820, almost four times as many Africans has been brought over to the Americas as Europeans. And consequently, they're the majority population in much of the Americas. Less so in our country, but even in places like South Carolina and Florida, they were by far the majority population. And as one could imagine, it was difficult for Europeans to control these large numbers of people, particularly in tropical places where they were more familiar with that kind of environment than Europeans. If you took a European to Brazil, all those palm trees and you know wet forest type vegetation was unnerving, difficult to deal with. Whereas to somebody from Central Africa, that was the kind of place where they'd grown up. And so in those places, they escaped in huge numbers. Nobody really knows how many, but they went into the interior and established these mixed communities with native people who themselves were fleeing European slavery. And they're called maroon societies. They have a whole bunch of different names. Maroon societies is the most common in English. And the term comes sort of tortuously from a Taino word, meaning the flight of an arrow, kind of a freedom image of freedom. And there are about 10,000 of these communities in Brazil alone, the most famous of which is called Palmares and is now a national park in Brazil. And there was a kingdom that endured for nearly a century and really threatened to unseat the entire colonial enterprise. And in a way, the revolution in Haiti, the revolution that was the first full-scale slave rebellion, was a maroon rebellion.
And in fact, the fledgling United States government did everything it could to suppress that, did it not?
Yes. Our role in the Haitian revolution isn't one of the brightest moments in American history. The slaves rebelled, kicked out the French, who were ruling the place. And then the United States and all the other slave-owning nations put a tremendous, crippling blockade on Haiti that lasted for decades and essentially prevented anything from entering the country and doomed it economically.
One of the things that just had one of those lightning bolt moments for me in reading your book, Mr. Mann, is the statement that you make rather plainly that the culture of the Americas is not, in fact, a European culture. It is a black African culture, is it not?
Well, what I'm trying to say by that is, again, if you're looking at this scientifically, what you have to say is, if almost four times as many Africans come to the Americas in the first three centuries, after Columbus, what are those people doing? Those are the people who are building the roads. Those are the people who are building the buildings, farming the fields, taking boats around the rivers. They're even a large percentage of the crews on slave ships. And so from that perspective, what you're seeing after Columbus is less meeting, you know, Europe coming to a nearly empty continent, but a meeting of Africa and native people in the Americas, with Europeans playing a demographically peripheral role.
And right down to the language, you know, this broadcast is originating in West Virginia, and I was born and raised in Alabama, and we think of the Southern accent, and we think about Miss Scarlet waiting for the getting ready to go to the barbecue at 12 Oaks or whatever. Even the language was shaped by the culture that was compelled in this direction, was it not?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's kind of curious about to me about American education is that, you know, all kids now are, you know, of course taught that slavery was bad, and, you know, which it was. But, you know, I find when I talk to students, and in fact to most people my own age, we know it was bad. We don't know anything about it. We don't know why it occurred or what impact it had. And, you know, in part, my book is an argument that all of these things, you know, were profound, both the, you know, the part it played, the impact at hand, and they can be tied to this idea of this ecological convulsion. Because without malaria and yellow fever, it's difficult to understand how we would have had the kind of large-scale slave societies that we did, you know, in places like the Carolinas and the Caribbean and Brazil.
Let's back up a minute to, if you don't mind, to a little bit earlier time. We talked about the agriculture. The myth that you put to rest, in my mind, at least in 1491, this idea of a vast and open continent merely waiting to embrace the Europeans who came here. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah. You know, most history books that when I went to school, I'm, you know, in my 50s now, but I think the same thing is still pretty much the case. You know, harken back to the early parts of the 20th century when, in fact, due to disease and mistreatment, there were very few native people. And they picked up on an image that came from the 19th century of the Great Forest. And, you know, people like Thoreau, you know, writing about the huge American forest. And it's only been in recent decades that we've learned that that kind of vast wilderness was, in fact, a recent phenomenon, and was caused because the original inhabitants of this place, the people who are constantly, you know, burning areas to keep them clear for agriculture and cutting down trees and doing all the kinds of things that you do when you're, you know, a large-scale society. Because they all died, the country reforested in the 17th century. And so by the time that my ancestors came here, you know, in 1807, they saw a huge forest, and they assumed that that was the way the landscape always had been. But in fact, it was a recent creation. And so when you talk to native people, they have a very different feeling about wilderness than, you know, some people who are conservationists. For them, it's less of a wilderness than a cemetery.
Well, indeed. And in fact, in 1493, you document a portion of the life of a woman whose name, I believe, is Rosa in Brazil, whose life story has been one of being constantly run off her land. But if you look, and there's a magnificent photograph that you have kindly labeled with various plant names, there's a resemblance even in her 20th century agriculture to the agriculture of pre-Columbian societies generally in the Americas, in that what looked like jungle wilderness to the Europeans arriving was actually very carefully managed agronomy, was it not?
Yes. So there's two things that are, you're absolutely right. And there's two things that are going on. In areas where people die, there is a reforestation, and the land is not empty, but emptied, if you follow.
Yes.
But then, where native people live, what you have is a kind of agriculture that's very unfamiliar to people in Europe and Asia. It's called polyculture. And that's where you're growing multiple crops at the same time. And in, you know, it ranges up from, you know, half a dozen to as many as 20 crops might be in a single small patch, and then multiple what they call semi-domesticates in managed areas around it. And the result is something that looks completely unlike a European farm. And to European eyes, it looks just like a mess. It's like, what are these people doing? And as a result, when when they would come in contact with these areas, they wouldn't recognize them even as farms. And this is especially true in places like the Amazon, where you have a very thin soils. And so, as you know, ecologists are constantly telling you, you can't cut down the trees and plant, you know, wheat or something like that, you know, an annual crop, because you expose the soil to the punishing, the heavy rain and the intense sun, and you wash away the nutrients and you turn the rest into something resembling brick, and you wreck the forest. So what native people did is they would clear the forest bit by bit, and they would plant annual crops, mainly tubers, like manioc or cassava. But then the main thing was that what they did was called managing the succession. They would let the forest fill in the cleared areas, but with useful species. And there's a wonderful botanist named Charles Clement, who has worked for many, many years in Manaus, which is the largest city in the Amazon. And he's documented, I believe, 168 tree crops that are grown, that have been grown at various points in the Amazon. And so when you see these managed forests with dozens of different useful tree species, you know, but the point of my picture, which you kindly described, is that to somebody like me who's unfamiliar with it, it looks just like a forest, right?
And yeah, it looks like something that needs a weed eater.
Yeah, but to Donna Rosaria, who has planted and tended every single one of those trees, this is, you know, a flourishing farm. It's just something totally different than Europeans were used to seeing.
And one of those aha moments that I had way back with 1491, and you mentioned it again in 1493, is the principle, for, and it's an example of this, of planting one's beans along with one's corn. And from the time that I was a little boy and we would raise a little garden in the backyard, my West Virginian Appalachian mother, when we would plant a couple of rows of corn, in would go a couple of beans with every kernel of corn. And as a child, I said, "Well, you know, why that?" She says, "Well, all these other people are planting their beans separately, and they're going to have to work their butts off, putting up string and putting up poles and letting the beans climb the poles." She said, "Why let the beans climb the poles when you can let the beans climb the corn?" And so I'm reading in your books, and just had this sort of moment of intense connection with, you know, for all, you know, considering maize agriculture in the Americas, with about 10,000 years of just plain common sense. And that's what a lot of that pre-Columbian agriculture was, wasn't it?
I think, yeah, it was more than common sense. I mean, you're right, there is things like this which are common sense, but it was really a very clever kind of way to, you know, it's a completely different way of thinking about agriculture. What it is much, you know, Native American agriculture, much Indian agriculture, is really about creating artificial ecosystems that mimic natural ecosystems, that have something of the complexity of natural ecosystems. And so, therefore, it would often be based on what they call the three sisters, which are, you know, the corn goes up, there's beans around it, they twine up the corn, and then in the land around the bottom, you plant squash, which spreads out over the ground.
Exactly.
And holds back weeds. And so you're getting an extraordinary amount of production out of relatively small parcels of land. Now, it's more difficult to mechanize this kind of thing. And so there's a reason why, you know, farmers in the Midwest aren't doing it. Because it's so much simpler to just take something completely flat and just, you know, cut it all down. But this is a way of agriculture that the agronomists say has a lot to teach us, and maybe now with, you know, sort of more knowledge and better technology, we might be able to take some of those lessons and apply them to the future.
And the other part of this is that you mentioned Don Rosario's farm in the Amazon. Part of the vast wilderness myth was also that the Amazon was kind of this wet, squishy, prone to flooding, good for nothing, nowhere, that could never have supported any sort of major cultural growth. By virtue of your review of the extant research and literature, you also exploded that by way of pointing out again managed soils. Can you talk about the potsherds in the soil a little bit?
Sure. You know, as we were talking about before, much of the Amazon, and in fact many tropical areas in general, have really poor soils. And this is one of the main reasons that so many tropical countries are poor. It's just really hard to grow enough food in poor soil. native people in the Amazon came up with a technology that I should immediately say that this is all a very recent finding and an active area of investigation. So what I'm trying to summarize is sort of the current state of knowledge of something that will, you know, as people grow to understand it more, will change in the next few years. But as we understand it now, these areas, which are called, in my bad Portuguese, Terra Preta dos Indios, Black Indian Earth, were created by native people by putting huge amounts of charcoal into the soil. And the thinking now, for the reason for doing that, is that the soil as it presently is full of aluminum, which is kind of toxic. And so as a result, it's very poor in the kind of microorganisms, you know, bacteria and fungi and so forth, that make soil rich, that make soil literally alive, good soil. And so by burying soil, charcoal in there, which is made by cutting down the trees and then burning them in low temperature fires, you create a kind of soil within the soil, a place for beneficial microorganisms to hang out. And recent studies from Cornell, which has a terrific soil science department, and also the University of Sao Paulo, which also has a good one, have indicated that the sort of microorganisms that are in this changed soil are completely different than the ones that are in, you know, the adjacent unchanged soil. And these areas that are planted, which are scattered all up and down the Amazon basin, are, you know, have good long-lasting soils that can be planted for decades upon decades. And so what you're seeing here then is a completely different version of how to, you know, work with the earth. You know, you reshape the soil, and then instead of planting annual crops, you plant trees. And so it's a completely artificial ecosystem, but it's so rich that many of the areas that you know, conservationists regard as their highest priority, because they're the most rich and diverse areas in the Amazon, are precisely the areas that have been most affected by the human presence.
And so in the attempt to save them from human activity, it's actually a preservation of previous human activity.
Right. And there's a terrible irony in this, because it's not hard to find places that are regarded as exceptionally rich and beautiful and find that they have been tended in this way by the descendants of native people mixed in with these you know, former escaped slaves, these maroon communities. And yet when they're set up as parks, these people are regarded as squatters and kicked out.
And that has caused no end of grief among other places, principally in Brazil. Is that right?
Right, but it's throughout lowland South America, because you can find the same thing happening in Paraguay. You can find it happening in Peru, in Colombia, in Bolivia. It's been very, very difficult for scientists, governments, conservationists alike to realize that there are people here who have a long history of a useful and good relationships with the forest.
And not just the minuscule or microscopic isolated bands or tribes either, is it, Mr. Mann? It's a matter of
substantial populations.
Yeah, the hundreds of thousands, right?
Well, you know, actually, they in total, really nobody knows, but there are it's widely believed that there are millions of people in the Amazon. And the kinds of signs that show this are in the western Amazon, for example, in the Brazilian state of Acre, which is spelled Acre and looks like acre, and it's the westernmost state in Brazil, bang up against Peru. There's been a lot of illegal, you know, clearing for ranching and the sort of thing that environmentalists rightly decry. But one of the reasons it's bad is not because this land was never cleared before, because when they peel back the forest for these ranches, what they find are huge geometrical shapes cut into the earth, squares and circles and rectangles and so forth, hundreds of them stretching across an area all the way going down into the Pando and then the Beni in Bolivia. So you're looking at an area that's, you know, I think it's about 750, maybe even 1,000 miles long, completely covered with hundreds of these shapes. And it just doesn't make any sense to have them in a forest. You can't see them. And so the implication is pretty clearly that some large, well-organized society cut these, kind of, they're kind of like Nazca lines, you know, Amazon, the Xingu, which is a giant tributary of the even more giant main river. You know, a wonderful archaeologist named Michael Hackenberg, University in Florida, has discovered what he calls garden cities, which are these large networked communities that go all the way up and down these rivers. And he believes that they covered large chunks of the Amazon. And as these kind of findings roll in, there's another group, a Brazilian-American group that's in the central Amazon that's finding big patches of this terra preta. As these findings go on and on, the pictures, you know, all the arrows seem to be pointing in the same way. And they're all saying lots and lots of people used to live in this place. And they've figured out ways to adapt to it, ways that we might be able to learn something from.
And that's kind of where I want to go next, if you don't mind. I mentioned, you know, imagine an Italian meal without a tomato or that sort of thing. But the exportation of American foodstuffs to the other continents was not always necessarily a happy thing, was it?
Yeah. Often these crops do particularly well when they're taken out of their home environment. There's a phenomenon called ecological release. And what that is when I take something out of its home environment and place it in a new place, then, you know, plant it in a new place, it will do spectacularly well because the pests and pathogens, you know, its natural enemies that are present at home don't get transported with it. And there's a big example of that in the American Southeast right now, which is kudzu. Kudzu, which is known as kuzu in Japan, is this kind of innocuous little creature, you know, little thing that you see along the sides of roads. It's not a big deal at all. We transport it to the American South, and it covers, you know, millions of acres and goes over entire houses and climbs up telephone poles and really is completely out of control. And that's ecological release. Well, something the same happened when the potato comes to a place like Ireland or Germany. It's immensely productive. And it, you know, plays a huge role in European history as this gigantic calorie source comes and basically ends famine in Europe in the 16th and 17th century, in the 17th century, 18th century, I mean. But there's also a problem with ecological release, which is that nature finds a way often of closing the loop. And so in the mid-19th century, guano boats come. And the reason for this is that the potato, which revolutionizes agriculture in northern Europe, provides a way for agricultural reformers to tell these farmers who they think are stupid and so forth, of, you know, to plant massive, what we call monocultures, and to, you know, plant huge areas in a single type, of a single variety of potato, and thus, you know, boost yields and so forth. And then to make sure that everything goes, to inject artificial fertilizer. This is the beginning of what critics call industrial monoculture.
Right, because the guano contained vast amounts of nitrogen compounds.
Right, exactly. And they discover, and this is in the 1840s, that, which is something that native people have known for a long time, that off the coast of Peru are these low islands that seabirds have roosted on for millennia upon millennia and have built these incredible hills, mountains of guano, of bird excrement. And that is superb fertilizer. And so, beginning in the 1840s, they bring in slaves from China, and they have guano mines. They fill up these vessels with guano, and they take them to Europe. And there, they inadvertently bring along the late blight, which is a fungus-like organism that really, really likes potatoes. And it comes to Europe, and what it sees is an entire continent of breakfast. And in an extraordinary phenomenon, it arrives in the middle of 1845, and in just a couple of months, it covers an area that, from Ireland all the way to the Ukraine, and wipes out the potato crops. And in big chunks of Europe, like Ireland, people, you know, in Ireland, for example, about 40% of the people in Ireland ate no solid food other than the potatoes. When the blight comes, 40% of the people instantly lose their food supply. And replicated across Europe, it's a continent-wide calamity. It's the first modern agricultural disaster. About 2 million people die, a million of them alone in Ireland, and the repercussions last for decades.
Well, I had no idea until I read 1493 that the population of Ireland can largely be said still not to have recovered fully from the famine.
There are still fewer people in Ireland today than there were in 1845. And there's just not that many countries you can say it of. Maybe the only one in the entire world that has fewer people today within the same boundaries than it did 150 years ago. That's how severe the impact of the blight was.
Well, and this is this phenomenon is certainly not isolated or limited to the potato. One of our listeners, Kate, who has read the book in advance of our conversation, was absolutely stricken by your description of worldwide rubber tree culture.
Mm-hmm.
and what that means, because as you describe it, there's a massive monoculturification of a particular species of the rubber tree in Asia at this point. Is that right?
Right. And the reason for that is, I quote this wonderful geographer, Susanna Hecht, who points out that to have an industrial revolution, we needed three main raw materials. Steel, of course, you know, to build the engines. And then fossil fuels to make them go, you know, coal or oil or what have you. But the third thing is rubber. And that is because you need rubber for belts. And even more important, you need them for gaskets and tires. Because if you don't have a tire, you know, I don't know if you've ever ridden one of the old bicycles that they made before the invention of rubber tires. They're called bone shakers.
I have not, but I know what you're describing, and it's
right.
Not a very pleasant experience.
Yes, I had the luck, if that's the right word, of riding one for about a block on a cobblestone street. Man, afterwards I got off, and my wife said, "How was that?" And I said, "I'm really glad that we've had our children beforehand, because I don't know if it's good afterwards. It was awful." Anyway, and you also need them for gaskets, because if you have two pipes that go together and you're, you know, in a steam engine, the vibration will, you know, separate them and cause explosions. And so consequently, and you also need it for insulation. So to make an industrial revolution practicable, you need to have rubber for all these different purposes, the belts and the gaskets and so forth. Now, rubber, back then at least, is a natural substance, and it comes from the sap-like stuff called latex that's inside certain types of trees, and it's kind of like maple syrup. You tap the tree, and you get this latex, and then you boil it down, and the result is rubber, which then has to be vulcanized and so forth. But the rubber, high quality rubber, especially, comes from two varieties of tree, which are located in the Amazon. And so, in the end of the 19th century, there was a rubber boom in the Amazon. It was completely like a gold rush or something like that, you know, with the construction in Manaus, which, absurd things like a giant marble opera house and, you know, millionaires swanning around, smoking cigars wrapped in $100 bills. You know, all that kind of crazy stuff happened in the middle of the forest in Brazil. Now, European empires didn't like it much that their industrialization was dependent on something in this foreign country, Brazil. And so they made a number of efforts to seize parts of the rainforest. They got beaten back. But the thing that did succeed was when they, as the Brazilians put it, stole a bunch of rubber seeds. A guy named Hiram Wickham did this. And took them to Kew Gardens in London, and then they were transplanted to Southeast Asia. Now, it turns out that in the 20s and 30s, German chemists invented how to make synthetic rubber. And synthetic rubber, to this day, is not as good as natural rubber. If you want to have rubber for, you know, for high-tech purposes or for purposes, you know, where safety is really important, such as in radial tires or airplane tires or, you know, high-temperature kind of, you use natural rubber. And to this day, natural rubber is at least 40% of the market, the world's market for rubber, and it's growing. And almost all of that natural rubber comes from gigantic plantations in Southeast Asia, which are created from the few seeds that survived when this fellow Wickham took them to, took all these seeds to Brazil. And so they're almost like an area, it's almost as if an area the size of Great Britain is covered with a few clone rubber trees. And, it's a gigantic
because largely, if a pest, if some sort of pest similar to the blight that struck the potatoes strikes those trees,
right,
it's going to get them all, right?
Right, and there's been, I've seen simulations that think that the entire thing could be wiped out in a few months. And we know this is possible because exactly the same thing happened on a smaller scale in Brazil, where there is a blight just like this. It's called South American leaf blight. And in the 20s and 30s, Henry Ford decided that he hated buying tires from these British guys in Southeast Asia, and decided to set up his own rubber plantations. And he bought a huge area. I think it's about 50 million acres. I don't remember the exact amount, but it's just an enormous area in Brazil, planted with rubber, and then it was all wiped out quite rapidly by South American leaf blight. And sooner or later, you know, much as AIDS came from Africa over here, South American leaf blight is going to go to Southeast Asia, and then when it does, it'll be a big problem. And the extraordinary thing is that despite the fact that botanists have been warning about this for decades, there's been absolutely no progress made towards, you know, breeding resistant trees or instituting, you know, travel bans or, you know, any of the kinds of things that you might expect.
And you even had a personal experience with that insofar as once when you got there to look at the rubber farms, nobody really cared where you'd been or what you were wearing. When
I flew directly from Brazil to China in the course of researching this book, and then I went to southern China, and as I was crossing over the border into Laos, which is, you know, a big rubber country, I suddenly wondered, are the border guards going to get upset about the Brazilian stamps on my passport? And then I thought, well, maybe they should be. I mean, maybe they could spray my shoes or something, the kind of way you do if you for hoof and mouth disease.
Right.
If you've been in a country with hoof and mouth disease, you're supposed to go to the customs people and have them spray your shoes and other clothing. And so I thought, well, maybe I should do that because I really hated the idea that I would cause it, right? So I went to them, and they just looked at me like I was crazy.
And you know, one of the principal points out of that is the fact that it's exactly those kind of transmission vectors that wind up being the source of these disasters, is it not?
Exactly. Fortunately, it didn't happen, so you didn't see the headline, you know, freelance writer causes worldwide economic collapse.
But just because it wasn't you doesn't mean it won't be someone else.
Right. It's kind of like throwing darts, you know. You throw enough darts, you hit a bullseye. And every traveler who goes that way is like one of the darts.
And even with something like the potato blight, Mr. Mann, we are not that far removed from it. Just because that one ended does not mean that another one is not possible. And with all of these transplanted monocultures, there is, in fact, a constant battle, is there not, to stay one step ahead of the bug?
Yes. You know, I live in an agricultural community, and it's quite striking when you talk to farmers, you know, how much stuff they have to put on their potatoes to protect them from, you know, potato blight and the Colorado potato beetle and, you know, all the other pests that come on their monocultures, to the extent that some of the people in the next town over from me told me that they don't let their kids go out into their fields because they think it's dangerous. And, you know, you think, wait a minute, this isn't right. You know, farming shouldn't be a toxic act. It's, you know, you don't have to be, you know, a flag waving, you know, organic type to say to yourself, there's something awry here. And what has happened is we've been inducted in something called the toxic treadmill, in which, you know, these bugs are, you know, doused with chemicals and they adapt. They're incredibly good at it. And so every year they have to come up with new chemicals and they have to repeatedly douse the crops in them. They're doused about every 2 or 3 weeks. While they're growing, at least in my area, and you know, it's hard to imagine how that this can keep going for a long time.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is that, to a certain extent, we can, you know, with granted, hindsight is 20/20, and we look back and we see things that happened, and they were a product of ignorance, not stupidity, but ignorance,
mm-hmm.
and. We can sort of forgive that, can't we? They didn't know any better. You say the same thing about a three-year-old.
Yeah.
But here in the 21st century, knowing what, as you note, botanists know, biologists know, zoologists know, to go forward and still be making these same stupid mistakes, that seems a little bit more subject to condemnation. Recount, if you will, please, the story of the snail.
Oh, my God. The golden apple snail.
Yeah, 1979, right?
Right. yes, you know, that's a snail that was repeatedly introduced to various Asian countries with the idea that it would create, essentially would create an escargot industry. And it turns out they always escape, and they don't seem to have any natural enemies in these Asian countries. And it also turns out that they really, really like rice. And so they become this gigantic pest.
Which they've never really been exposed to before, right? Again,
right.
It's breakfast.
No. Exactly. And so they go into these areas. And it's funny that you should say that, because I'm about, in a few months, I'm about to go to the Philippines again and go back and look at some of these areas that where the farmers have essentially been driven out of their fields by these animals that, you know, the snails that were introduced deliberately as part of aid programs.
Yeah, and you'll forgive me if I find at least moderate, it's deadly serious, but forgive me if I find the idea of an escaping snail at least moderately humorous.
Yeah.
Come on, guys!
Well, you know, it is very difficult to contain, you know, natural creatures, because, you know, what are they doing? They're constantly looking for a new source of nourishment, as are we all. And so you have to be on the case 24/7. And, you know, that's just very, very difficult to maintain, especially with you know, seeds and, you know, other small things. So you get all kinds of invasions of invertebrates and that you wouldn't expect. Another big problem for these folks in the Philippines is invasive earthworms. And in fact, I have, you know, in my collected papers, lots and lots of scientists warning about the giant problem of invading earthworms, which are something that most of us don't even think about, and yet are so fundamental to ecosystems that when one earthworm pushes aside another, it can dramatically change the character of the entire place.
It is indeed amazing, and I find myself wondering if, and I think this is sort of what our listener Kate was getting at, is the eventual victory of the predators, hard to see a snail or a worm as a predator, but they are, is it inevitable?
Well, there's a couple of things that you can say in response, and not only just the fact that really nothing is inevitable. In this particular realm, but you know, one of the reasons that the snails are flourishing and the worms are flourishing is that their natural enemies haven't been transported along with them. And sooner or later, either nature will close the loop, or when they get to be so numerous, they will become, you know, the source of food for everything else. And so, in the long run, you know, these things even out. The problem is the long run is very long, you know, in human terms.
Yes.
Nature, you know, which thinks in the long term, doesn't care if it takes 3 or 4 centuries for something to adapt to the new earthworms or the new snails. We do. 3 or 4 centuries of misery is not something we want to experience.
And the speaking of miseries, in 1493, you describe what happens when silver, the influx of American silver, hits the world market. I remarked on the program the other night, a couple of weeks ago maybe, that, you know, here in American politics, we now have a certain segment of, I think, daffy people who want to return America to the gold standard or the silver standard, which is a commodity-based standard in essence. And I thought, you know, golly, if Ron Paul sat down and read part of 1493 to Rand Paul, his son, as a bedtime story, Rand would have nightmares, because you show very clearly that precious metal based economy, it's already been tried on a grand scale, and it led to disaster, did it not?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that kind of money, where you have, you know, silver and gold, and this is, you know, certainly not, you know, unique to me. This is something that the overwhelming majority of economists will tell you, is that what a government wants to do is to control the money supply. And, you know, that's what the Federal Reserve is supposed to try to do, right? You know, to control, because if it uncontrollably prints money, you have hyperinflation. If it doesn't print enough, you have deflation. Well, the problem with having a money based on gold or silver is that nobody controls the supply. You know, it's vulnerable to external shocks. So, you have an argument now, where Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney is saying that Russia is sort of our number one enemy. Let's suppose that's true for the moment. Russia has huge, relatively untapped gold reserves. If we went back on the gold standard, what we would be doing is essentially letting our currency be in the control of Russia, which, you know, is something that, Mr. Romney has suggested is a very bad idea. And this isn't really a theoretical, kind of...
No, this is actual. We've seen this in process.
And so what you're referring to when I talk about the book is that, you know, from the European point of view, we've been talking about all this exchange of, animals and plants and microbes and so forth. Almost all this was invisible to Europeans, at the time. What they were concerned with, and from their point of view, the big event, was that in 1545, Spain discovered in southern Bolivia the world's largest silver strike, as close to a mountain of pure silver as geology allows, called Potosí. And it quickly became a boom town. It quickly, in fact, became the biggest city in the Americas. Way up in the Andes, 13,000 feet up in the Andes, was this, kind of frontier boom town. And vast amounts of silver poured out of it, and also out of some large silver mines that were discovered in Mexico. And the result was that between 1545 and, say, 1745, the world supply of silver doubled, maybe even tripled. And because silver was currency, in much of the world, this had enormous impacts all over the world. And to sum it all up, the impacts were easily as much negative as positive.
And it resulted in disaster. Well, Mr. Mann, you have been extremely generous with your time this evening. Let me ask you, in wrapping up, I suppose, What do you see, or what does your research in producing both books actually? What does it tell you? The value of history is the value of being able to extrapolate forward. Where are we going in the homogenocene?
Well, I guess for me, to rephrase the question a little bit, the value of history is it helps tell you where you are.
True.
And how you got there. And one of the things that I learned is that, what we've been talking about, though we haven't mentioned the word, is globalization.
Yes.
And that and one of the lessons that I've learned from this is that globalization is not a recent phenomenon. It started with Columbus, and the circle really closed with it when Spain established the colony of Manila in 1571, which is where Spain finally got to have, continuous trade with China, which had been, after all, Columbus's goal. Remember, he was trying to get to China. And then the entire world, through the Spanish Empire, was looped in had a single chain of commerce, a single network of commerce. And that all starts, in the 16th century. In fact, at one point, my editor rather unkindly suggested that the book should be called "Ha ha, Tom Friedman, the world has been flat for 400 years. of course, for some reason we decided that that was actually not a particularly good title.
Well, it really doesn't work in Siri with 1491, but I understand his impulse.
Right. These two books, 1491 and Ha ha, Tom Friedman. It helps you when you start reading about all these things that are going on because of globalization. I want to say, this is something that we've been seeing for a very long time. It can have huge impact, but, sort of calm down. We've seen this stuff before. At the same time, I wish that the policyholders who talk about globalization wouldn't be so glib about some of the environmental consequences, because one of the things that we've learned is that they are rarely foreseen and often uncontrollable. And it just seems silly to suppose kind of consequence will never happen again.
And the odd thing for me is that, it informs my everyday existence, living here in central southern West Virginia. You know, they've blown up 500 mountains and buried 2,000 miles of streams in Appalachia, all in search of coal.
Mm-hmm.
And where it used to be that that was done for purposes of firing electrical plants and steel mills in the United States, now we have seen, you know, globalization has literally come to my back door, such that a huge mountaintop removal operation 6 miles from me, every last fleck, lump, speck, ton of coal that comes out of that mountain, that destroyed, toxic place now, is going to India.
Wow.
And other mountains are going to China.
Right.
And another outfit, a fellow by the name of Jim Justice, sold off a bunch of his holdings, and those flattened mountains have been transported to Russia. And so one of those little aha moments that these books are so filled with was when I read you very carefully describing plantation culture and the necessity for transport and the necessity for a workforce, and I thought immediately of the Foxconn debacle going on in China with the iPhone and the iPad and all the other technology manufacturers. But closer to home, my father worked in a factory that made aluminum and silicon metal to alloy with that aluminum. And in industrial America, which many people rightly lament the demise of, daddy went to work at the plant. And when I realized that the plant was just a shortened, niced up version of daddy went to work at the plantation, my view instantaneously changed. And that's one of the magical things about what you have done here, is you've made it possible, as you said, and it's exactly right, to see where we are. We are not that far displaced from 400 years ago, because we're still using the same methodologies and the same terminologies. There's a reason for having rubber plantations in Southeast Asia, and for the Chinese to decide that they want, and American tire manufacturers to decide they want to manufacture in China. It's closer to the rubber, right?
Right.
And yet, we wonder about the net effects of that, to the extent that European agriculture forever changed, for instance, the tidewater region of Virginia and the Carolinas. So too, this region now is being changed irrevocably by a remorseless search for coal, and the story of that doesn't seem to have a happy ending. And I guess that's what frightens me. Yeah, we have seen it before, but with the Apple snail in 1979, you wonder if anybody's paying attention.
One of the things that I took home from this is that often plantations have absentee owners. You know, the work is all being done in place A, but the owners are all in place B, thousands of miles away.
Yes.
And for hundreds of years, absentee owners of plantations have not been interested particularly in the welfare of the place where they get their money from. And, one of the things I hear, I don't know particularly very much about the coal industry, but one of the things that I hear from you is, effectively, chunks of West Virginia are now owned by the Chinese and the Indians and the Russians. And history suggests that those folks aren't going to be particularly interested in the welfare of you folks. I mean, why should they? They're thousands of miles away.
Yeah, they don't live in the mess they make.
Yeah, they don't live in the mess they make. And this has been, as I tried to describe in the book, a source of longstanding environmental problems now for centuries. Absentee owners in Britain and the Netherlands of sugar plantations in the Caribbean created an awful mess. And absentee owners of tobacco plantations in London and Spain created a terrible mess in the southeastern United States, and it goes on and on and on. And so this isn't to say that we should ban foreign ownership or something. What needs to be, you need to have, in the cases where it hasn't caused a mess, is you have robust local institutions that say, you know what, you have to pay attention. You know, otherwise you can't operate. And but there's a lot of trouble in places in which there aren't those kind of robust institutions.
And of course, the political corruption goes hand in hand with it, whether it be Southern West Virginia or Chevron in Nigeria,
or what have you. Yes, political corruption, and what happens then is that these absentee owners often, you know, effectively pay off the local elites in one way or another. You know, it couldn't be even quite legally by, you know, making sure that they and their families get good jobs, you know, after they leave political power. There's all kinds of ways for local elites not to be thinking about the interests of the people around them. And so this is a constant problem with globalization. It doesn't mean that globalization is inherently evil, but it does mean that we have to pay, you know, that history tells us that we have to pay attention to this kind of problem.
May I ask what you're working on now?
Oh, sure. But I'm going to have to tell you it's kind of vague and
well, I kind of have a feeling you're at the end of the 1400
cycle. I've run out of numbers. I'm thinking really about the fact I have a couple of kids, 14 and 9 years old, and I'm just sort of thinking about the fact that when they're my age, there's going to be almost 10 billion people in the world. And how exactly are we going to manage that? How is that going to happen?
If we can manage it.
Yeah, well, if we do it, how? And not so much a polemic, but just, you know, people, and generally there seems to be two sort of broad visions of how we're going to do it. I'm speaking very broadly. And one says that we have to cut back. And that's kind of the Al Gore approach, if you like. You know, put on our cardigan sweaters, turn down the heat, use less, have reduced the human footprint is the, you know, sort of
right
expression. And the other is that we use science and technology to kind of produce our way out of this problem. And these two ways of thinking are completely opposed to each other.
That they are.
They also, to me, seem rather vague. And so
well, using science and technology to get out of it sounds, to use a poker analogy, sounds a little bit like betting on the come, right?
Well, you know, the answer is okay. So I'm thinking about it already, but we say, okay, let's take both of these approaches seriously. How would you, from what we know here in 2012, you know, how, you know, if we're going to use science and technology to produce our way, how exactly would we do that? How would that work? And similarly, if we cut back, how does that work? I mean, all of these sound, you know, sort of broadly sensible. But then when you get down to the nuts and bolts, they're both very, very difficult to do.
Well, they are indeed, and I can't imagine that you're going to dig too deeply into that before you get into the energy substructure of the entire world. And as you work on it, Mr. Mann, you've been very gracious and very generous with your time. And if you need to know anything about living in America's third world coal colony, I would certainly be willing to point you in any direction you need to go on that.
Well, that's extremely generous of you, and I thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It has been a real joy. Thank you very kindly.
Sure. My pleasure. Bye. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Charles C. Mann, author of 1491 and 1493, 1493 being the most recent of the two books. You don't have to read 1491 to get anything out of 1493, but taken together, they comprise, on his part, a masterwork of understanding both where we've been, where we are, and I will submit where we are going. You can, of course, get 1493 and 1491. Are both widely available, and I just recommend reading them. They are engaging. They are written in a style that is every bit as edge of your seat as any thriller or any mystery. And even though it's history to a certain extent, you still don't exactly know how it ends. Now, because you listen to the horn, and you may have heard a conversation with our buddy Jim a few months back, You know a little bit about Henry Ford's Rubber Tree Folly. And like I said, I've been transported by this book for the last several weeks. And ending it, I was like, oh, damn. This is the same kind of feeling I got at the end of The Lord of the Rings, you know, because I'll never read it for the first time again. And when a book does that to you, you know that you have something in your hands that is incredibly special. So I have not waxed on about a book like this in quite some time. And I'm certain, I didn't even get a complimentary copy of the book in return for the, no, there was nothing changed hands here. This is just the simple desire to see something really important get wider traction and get more people talking about it. Because, you know, just as I noted that the scientists and the normal people agree that the continents broke into continents 200 million years ago, but there is a sizable, probably something on the order of 20% of the population of the United States thinks that that happened 3.5 weeks ago at 2:16 p.m. on a Tuesday. Well, the only way we ever push back against that is by knowing what really happened. And by understanding where a globalized future takes us, by knowing where a globalized future has taken us thus far. So that was a magnificent hour of conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as did I. We're going to take a little break, and we will come back. Your phone calls, the lines are open. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304. 658-3333. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. We'll be back.
Just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows an ant can't move a rubber tree plant.
But he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky hopes.
So anytime you're getting low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
When troubles call and your back's to the wall, there's a lot to be learned that won't could fall.
Once there was a silly old ram, thought he'd punch a hole in a dam. No one could make that ram scram. He kept butting that dam,
'cause he had high hopes. He had high hopes. He had high apple pie in the sky hopes.
So anytime you're feeling bad, instead of feeling sad, just remember that ram. Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt
dam. Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt dam.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt dam.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
A couple of emails before we go to the phones. You know the number, 877-443-2366. 877-LIBERAL-4, head on. 304-658-3333 if you want to save us the toll-free charges. The first one coming from my head writer, David, in Tennessee, noting with regard to the farming techniques Charles C. Mann described, wasn't that old smart farming based on generations of observe, record, learn, use the knowledge? And it was. But the problem you have with Europeans entering terra incognita is that because they were the enlightened sons of Mother Church, they assumed that no one else had anything to teach them. And consequently, since everyone that they were running into turned out to be heathens, they obviously had no knowledge that wasn't demonic in nature. And so consequently, those eons of those generation upon generations of learning based upon empirically gathered data were thrown by the wayside by white Europe as useless. And boom, you get what you get. This note in from Andy, he says, Mr. Mann's comment, globalization is not inherently evil. Andy says, really? After you explain China, India, and Russia owning mountains in West Virginia, then Mr. Charles C. Mann saying globalization is not inherently evil didn't make sense. Globalization benefits the top 1%. I just don't see it. Don't see it benefiting the 99%. I do see it bringing exploitation, pain, want, and greed, lies, and agony to the vast majority of us. And those are, I would submit, symptoms of the disease and not the cause. Globalization itself, and I think this is what Mr. Mann was getting at, isn't evil any more than a knife is inherently evil. However, if you put the knife in the hands of a madman, it becomes wicked because of the use put to it. And by that I mean, look at the structures that you had in place. One of the things that you'll find out, and I think he alludes to it if I recall correctly, one of the things that you find out is that although it would be 1776 before Adam Smith named capitalism capitalism, what you had was a royalty-based monarchical capitalism in sort of proto-in-utero form that develops with the discovery of the so-called New World, of course. Even to say discovery of the New World is freighted with Eurocentric bigotry. Because I'm pretty sure that you could ask any number of the peoples, the millions of people, the more people in the New World than there were in the Old. And they would tell you in their own well-developed tongue that they didn't need any discovering. They'd been doing very, very well, thank you very much. In Eurasia and Africa, but particularly Eurasia, plagues of cycles of famine and plenty, and you know, it's even recorded in the Bible in the dream of Joseph. The agriculture they had developed was predicated on failure. Agriculture first develops in the Old World in what's it called, the Fertile Crescent, and then in Mesopotamia it develops as well, and that's because of irrigation from the Tigris and the Euphrates River. But the Tigris and Euphrates River irrigation that was developed did what irrigation always does, and that is to create salinity problems, and the soil irrigated eventually gets ruined. Those were not the problems that agriculture faced in the New World. Consider, if you will, the vanishing now. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, Dr. John sent me an article from the Washington Post about the vanishing chinampas of Mexico City. That was not something the Spaniards brought. Lake Texcoco was a semi-brackish with some freshwater sources lake in the Valley of Mexico, and the place where the Mexica people eventually settled was literally the worst piece of real estate in the entire neighborhood. You know, they got the corner property next to the four lane where the children couldn't even go out and play, relatively speaking. But they adapted and they developed things that were sustainable within the context of their environs that not only sustained, but thrived. So too in the Amazon culture Mr. Mann described. And they supported massive populations. The Tenochtitlan that Hernan Cortes leveled was easily a rival to any city on planet Earth, and the better of many of them. But in all of these instances, just as with the white European assumption that anything that these people knew, didn't even look like agriculture. The white folks who settled at Jamestown went on an absolute binge of tobacco raising. And in so doing, they completely wrecked the ecology of thousands of years. And they did it for profit. They did it for gain. Some would say that that is inherent in the human being. And, you know, to seek comfort, to seek gain, to compete, to a certain extent, I think, is. But there are ways and there are ways. And ultimately, the reason globalization then and globalization now benefits the 1% to the sorry misery of the 99% is not because of globalization. There is no harm in contact between worlds, if you will. The harm lies in the exploitation. The harm lies in the system. You know, when NAFTA was first going through, and everybody and it seemed like everybody and their cousin was a globalizer during the Clinton administration, some people said, you know, this is not going to work out like you think it is, because it was presented as this model. It was going to bring freedom and frisbee and wheat checks to everybody on the planet. But some people looked up and said, wait a minute. How is this going to be so great if all it does is create an economic race to the bottom? If the only reason for knitting sweaters in Burma is because you can pay the worker a penny a day and chain them to the table versus a free person who can be paid a living wage and go home and feed their children, then all you're going to do is destroy the economy of the person who has the decent life. And the one percenters and the University of Chicago types said, precisely, and that's what we're going to do. If, on the other hand, economically, you go to Burma and you say, we're going to pay you so that you're going to have the same lifestyle as the person, then eventually I get the argument about a rising tide lifting all boats. But it is the application of inequality as a function of economic theory that makes globalization a problem. Because you know what? If I go over to India to some poor soul who lives next to some godforsaken open-pit coal mine, and I tell them what's going on back here, they're going to say, I hate that for you, because I hate it for me, and we're in the same boat. And that is globalization, too. Globalization isn't just the ability to for the 1% to torment and exploit the 99%. In it is also the inherent seed, the inherent ability of the 99% to join together and say, no more. No more. So just my few pennies worth on that topic. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, Jim, what's up?
First, I enjoyed your interview very much with the author.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a book well worth owning.
Oh, well, yeah, the two are on their way here.
Very good. I'm glad to know it.
And secondly, basically what we're talking about here with this globalization thing with so many inequities is what I would consider to be an economic necrosis.
It largely is, and when you get 1493... and you read about the impact of New World products on, say, a corrupt and crumbling Chinese empire, it's exactly as you describe it.
Eventually, the tissue will be eaten and dissolved, the economic tissue, and there is no equal balance there. And, of course, so many people have to suffer, like mentioned before, the term economic necrosis. And that's exactly what it is. I mean, it happened back in the 15th century. I mean, the Church of the Arrogance under Alexander the VI. Remember him?
Yep.
Rodrigo Borgia. And children like the Great Gathering. Little boys that don't want to at midnight. On 4 June 1497, he divided the world between, the new world between Spain and Portugal.
Absolutely. The line of demarcation.
By what mandate he would be able to do such a thing as to divide?
Well, by the same mandate that, that people could be wantonly killed for, not being Christian.
Well, the horrors, for example, in Peru. The mind he mentioned that Potosi, San Luis Potosi.
And he documents, Mr. Mann does, in tremendous detail, the horrors that accompanied San Luis Potosi.
Absolutely, absolutely. Getting that silver out to the New World and putting it on the Spanish flota that sail once a year for the New World. And, you know, basically, what did it do for Spain's economy? It wrecked Spain's economy because they no longer depended on anything that they could do independently there.
Well, it didn't just wreck Spain's. It wrecked China's. It wrecked England's. Ultimately, that mass infusion of silver, you know, in those 200 years that Mr. Mann discussed, the value of silver on the world market decreased by half, if not more.
Right, it did. And, of course, for the persons who were living in the first generation or so, it was great to have all that wealth coming in from the New World. But at what price? At what horrible price of, number one, human degradation, and, number two, eventually economic inflation and ruin?
You know, that there had, I was a little, well, it sort of angered me when I got Mike's email over the weekend talking about that professor who answered his question. There wasn't any history before Columbus. That kind of benighted ignorance is past my ability to tolerate. And this, you know, this from a history professor.
Excuse me, I do appear somewhat incredulous at that remark. My God, I mean, these people in the New World lived in their own, I guess, version, and I'm using this term very loosely, in their own Garden of Eden, so to speak.
It was. It was. In many ways, it was a Garden of Eden. Now, you know, we say things like that being very careful to understand that we got to watch ourselves to keep from wandering off into noble savage land, because there certainly was warfare, there was killing, there was raiding, there was death, there were struggles over land. This land was, in fact, more populous than Europe and Asia.
But inherently, among these native peoples, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was a definite respect for the land.
Absolutely. Concepts of land ownership were foreign, except to the extent that in some of the more advanced cultures, like the Triple Alliance in the Valley of Mexico, or the culture in Peru, there was land ownership to the extent that, and this is how bizarre it can get, when one Inca, you know, the people weren't the Inca, the ruler was the Inca, but you know that. When one Inca died...
Pachamanc, those last Incas who ruled when Pizarro came or before he came.
Right, Atahualpa and the like.
Atahualpa too.
Cuauhtemoc was in Mexico. But when one Inca died...
Right, the successor of Montezuma.
Right. When one Inca died, though, he was mummified, and all of his properties, his castles, his holdings, were deemed to be still his. So that there was no estate succession or anything. The next Inca had to go and build his own. He had to do it from the... And of course, that's not something that's going to sustain for a long time, and that particular culture was, like the Mexica culture, only a couple of 300 years old. But you know, those concepts did exist, but by and large, you know, the lord of a particular Mexica town would own the land per se, but people would work it and have the possession of it. I guess you would look at it as sort of it wasn't feudalism in the way that European feudalism existed, but it was a sort of tenancy. But by the same token, what also did obtain, and I may be running a little far afield, and I stand to be corrected by Dr. John if I really hit a bump in the road, what did obtain is that there was what I guess I would call a generational respect, so that you didn't just do things willy-nilly of what might happen down the road.
It would appear so. You know, recently my nephew visited Machu Picchu.
Oh, wow.
And I have on the back of a rocking chair a beautiful vicuna throw that was woven there. And the artistry of that particular piece of fabric is just incredible. And when you think about the stones of the structures at Machu Picchu, and how they were put together like this huge puzzle that you can't even get a credit card or a razor blade between them. I mean, these people were incredibly advanced.
And doing it without draft animals, if you can imagine that.
I mean, you know, I don't even know if they even knew the use of the wheel.
They knew of the wheel, but they had no use for big wheels because it takes big animals to pull things that have big wheels.
And they basically had, what, llamas, so that was it?
Yeah, and that was just the Inca culture, the Andean culture, I should say.
Right.
But one of the more fascinating things that I find in that particular culture, Jim, relating to where we live, you know, every time it rains in McDowell County or Mingo County or Logan County or Boone County or any of the mountaintop removal counties, there's horrible, horrible flooding. Because these rotten bastards that do these mountaintop removal jobs don't give a damn. They deforest everything, and boom, you're done. But if you look at the hydrology and the hydrogeology of Machu Picchu, what you find out is that they, by virtue of building a city on top of a sacred mountain, and that's the thing, that's the trick, they viewed the mountain as sacred in and of itself, what you find is that they expended tremendous scientific effort in making sure that runoff did not flood the valley below. And that system works to this day. It worked without a human being anywhere to maintain it.
Are you referring to the terracing of the mountains and stuff like that, Bob?
Well, and particularly the terracing of Machu Picchu.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, absolutely, because they knew the value of rain. They knew the value of soil because of the terrain in which they were living. And, you know, like I said, they were great conservators of the land, much more so than we have been here recently. I mean, we just are basically raping and pillaging everything. And, you know, you were referring to no reforestation of mountaintop removal. They haven't done anything to replace that.
A tree won't grow there. You know, I remember when some Virginia Tech scientist proudly announced that they were growing 10-year-old oak trees on a mountaintop removal site, and Judy Bonds, God rest her soul, responded, "Well, hell, I can grow an oak tree 10 years old in a bucket from Lowe's." And it's true. And probably have a more viable oak tree at year 12 or 20. Because that oak tree on that mountaintop removal site gonna die. Because it can't sink a taproot into anything. Because there's nothing there to sink it into.
No, you can't grow a tree on rocks. Or soil has been poisoned, can you?
No, damn few of them at least.
And, you know, going to the Aztecs, what, you know, has always fascinated me about them was, now this is his, you know, according to tradition and legend, but the reason they built the city of Tenochtitlan was because they saw an eagle with a serpent in its claws. That's
perched on a cactus.
Well, basically on Aguilar con Serpiente, and that's on the flag of Mexico today.
True.
And they considered that to be a divine sign. And in the middle of this bog, they built an entire city with causeways and, of course, everything. I guess they had to drag in and build on that swamp land that was viable enough to support aqueducts, pyramids. I'm sure when the Spanish came and saw that city, they absolutely marveled.
Well, one of the things you'll find out if you read, and there are some great books out there on the topic, the background on it is that the Spaniards sought to erase every last vestige of the history of that people, and they largely succeeded, but with some they did not, and what remains is fascinating. And what you'll find out, Jim, is that just as the Spaniards erased the Mexicas' history, the Mexicas rewrote their own. And it came during the reign of a revered speaker by the name of Itzcoatl. And he's the one who really, really began consolidating power and made it made the Mexica people a force to be reckoned with, such that they eventually formed the Triple Alliance with the other two nations around Lake Texcoco. But what he did is, the reason you get that snake holding that eagle holding a snake in its beak, sitting atop a cactus motif, was to provide a sense of divine destiny, to the Mexica people, because the real history of it was that they were late arrivers to the Valley of Mexico. All the good real estate was taken, and they were left to deal as best they could, with a swamp.
Now, basically, who was there? Like, the Olmecs were there, the Chichimecs, if I'm not pronouncing it correctly, they were also there, and the Aztecs were basically a conquering nation, were they not?
No, they were not. They were not at all. They all traced their lineages variously, to what, and Chichimeca, their term, but that was for all the wandering tribes of the north. And what happened is, slowly but surely, some of them, sooner rather than later, settled the area around the Valley of Mexico. Teotihuacan and the Toltec people, Toltec is a Mexica Nahuatl word that just means really old people. And, Teotihuacan is city of the gods. They had no idea where those people came from, but they were the inheritors of their cultural traditions. But the people of Tlaxcala and oh, I can't remember all the names right now, settled first. And they had settled civilizations when that last remnant band that called themselves the Mexica came in and were left to settle on the swamp. So, you know, and one of the things I wanted to point out to you, because it was Kate who mentioned in an email Friday night the fact that she was really tickled by getting turned on to Marcus Aurelius. There is a noble of that era who is referred to as the American Marcus Aurelius. And some of his poetry, despite the fact that the Spaniards tried to burn their culture to the ground, including vast libraries of fawnskin books.
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, for example, if you look at the Mayans, for example, they burned all the books of the Mayans. The only thing that survived now is the Dresden Codex.
And the Florentine Codex and a number of others, as well as the cultural work of Bernardo de Sahagún and Bernardino de las Casas. But what you'll find is some of the poetry of Nezahualcoyotl, which translates as fasting or starving coyote, survives. Now, this man built a palace complex on the east side of Lake Texcoco, the remains of which are still standing. And he built...
It's named Mexico City, right?
Well, yeah, it's adjacent to Mexico City if it hasn't been engulfed by it. But he fostered a culture... You can read about it on Wikipedia, for instance. It's at least a good jumping off place.
Yeah,
he was a patron of the arts. He was a patron of science. He was a patron of history and of music and learning, and was a poet of the first order in his own right. And his poetry remains to this day. And to sit down and read the work of Nezahualcoyotl is like reading a modern gem.
Well, you know, Bob, it's so sad that the only thing that we've been led to remember the Aztecs by, as far as the
human sacrifice,
were the skull rack that had 100,000 skulls on it, and the gutters of Tenochtitlan that ran with blood when they had their sacrifices and stuff like that.
But remember who wrote those stories.
Yeah, I know. And, of course, the Spanish tried to make a haul in there, and the Aztecs had sort of gotten exactly wind of what they were, and they tried to escape, and it was called by the Spaniards the Noche Triste.
Correct.
They tried to make it back over one of the causeways that led into the city of the Aztec capital, and the Spaniards had a right rough time of it.
And the only reason the Spanish succeeded in the Valley of Mexico is because of the dominant position of the Triple Alliance and a particular cultural group that they had more or less isolated but had not been able to conquer.
Well, basically, I think they...
And they joined up, the oppressed people joined up with Cortez to enjoy the pleasure of finally overthrowing their overlords.
Well, yeah, because the Aztecs were the dominant power. They were an empire de facto in that area. And, you know, one more thing, and I'll get off here. When the Spanish brought pigs into the New World, these pigs, it was just incredible how well they multiplied and how quickly. And, of course, when they were in the wild, they became these wild boars. And these wild boars impacted very seriously on the crops. And
oh, they'll eat you out of house and home.
And you know, the Native Americans didn't have fences and borders. They didn't need them. But, you know, when these pigs and their wild boar successors invaded their land, they would just literally, as you say, eat you out of house and home and devour their gardens. And, you know, the effects were totally catastrophic, you know, agriculturally.
Well, it absolutely was. And one of the things that Mr. Mann points out is that the first man ever to raise wheat in the New World was an African former slave who became a confidant of Cortez and came into a few grains of actual wheat, which he then planted and lovingly tended until he could harvest and harvest and harvest and plant an entire crop. This book is full of surprises. You are going to be absolutely transported, I think, when you dive into them, Jim.
Well, I've read a lot about this period, and of course, in my courses in expansion of Europe into the New World, you know, when I was in graduate school, I learned some of this stuff, and it is very enlightening, and it proves the rape and pillage of the old world against the new. And I am so glad he mentioned Henry Ford's expedition in the Amazon. That guy built an entire city down there. Schools, churches, boulevards, everything. Thinking he could grow his own rubber, make his own tires from that rubber, and guess what?
Didn't work out.
No, the ruins are still there.
Just as the ruins are in Colbert County, Alabama, of his attempt to break nascent labor organizing by refounding his automobile empire in northwest Alabama, and it all came to nothing when the federal government refused to knuckle under and sell him Wilson Dam.
I didn't know about that.
The streets, he laid out streets, there were buildings, it was called Ford City, Alabama. And to this day, Muscle Shoals, Alabama has the same main drag names as Detroit, Michigan. Avalon and Woodward.
You know, Henry Ford cut with a 2/8 sword, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And
you know, it's a strange thing. Back when Hitler was in power, he used to have these things that idolized Henry Ford because he was a teetotaler and a non-smoker and hated any type of work or organization.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, let's not forget he was a flippin' Nazi.
Yeah, he was. I mean, you know, he certainly made his contributions, but there's certain detriments. I mean, he developed the assembly line and stuff like that, but, oh, Lord, these rubber barons and these industrial magnates.
And that's the point I was trying to make, Jim, in responding to Andy's email. There's nothing wrong with progress. It is the fact that it's the system in which it's done. And we're sort of trapped in this feedback loop of that there's only capitalism and there's only communism and, you know, maybe social democracy, but there's got to be something else out there. There's got to be a way.
I would think it would be an equal balance.
Well, you know what? If
a type of quid pro quo system in which both sides can profit, a mutual symbiosis and not a necrotic symbiosis. Do you follow me, Bob?
Well, I do. And frankly, I think you'd remedy a lot of it if you made them, as we noted in the conversation, live where they make their mess. If Don Blankenship he can have as big a mansion as he wants, Jim, I got no problem with that. But if Don Blankenship's mansion had to sit at the foot of a mountaintop removal job and get flooded four times a year, you know what? The flooding problem with mountaintop removal would end.
I don't think he'd like it. And basically, it's a violation of one principle. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Exactly. And that's why that concept is embodied in every major world religion.
Exactly. And these people, they completely, you know, forget that. And not they don't forget it, they ignore it at the risk of, you know, the other person's detriment and their own enrichment.
You know, look at, and I've mentioned this before, and he gets mentioned in 1493 in passing because he was part of a really bad run of luck that Hernan Cortes had. Bernardo de las Casas is a beatified person in the Catholic Church.
And he was
the first protector of the Indians.
And yeah, he was. As a matter of fact, you know, he appealed to the Vatican, and of course, you know, the Vatican said we can't have slavery, and we must try to...
And they came up with
and make these people good God-fearing Christians. But how can you make a person a good God-fearing Christian when you work them like animals and you make of their situation what was supposedly or actually done by the Egyptians to the Hebrews, you know, their modus operandi. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I do. And but what happened is that Bernardo de las Casas made this profound appeal, was named protector of the Indians, and was threatened with assassination by the owners of the encomienda system.
Well, you know, you have several types of encomienda systems in the New World. You had the encomienda system, of course. That's what the Spanish based their land grants on and their huge plantations. And then you had the French called it the seigneurial system, in which French landlords would come in and own huge tracts of land. And the Dutch had another type of system called the patroons type.
Right, and they're all manifestations of the same thing that eventually morphs into capitalism.
Well, it was transportation, of European feudalism, basically is what it was. And that's in which everybody was not an owner, but a tenant, and had to go to the lord of the manor, or whether it was the encomendero, or the seigneur, or the patron, and render unto him what was his. And basically, depending on his mood or when he sat in that big chair every year, what you had left might not have been a whole lot.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wasn't too good.
Well, I think you're going to enjoy the books when they arrive, Jim. I'm quite certain of it.
Well, like I say, I enjoyed the interview tremendously, and it's been a very good program. By the way, one more thing, and I won't get on this tonight, but last night this program by James Cameron on the Titanic,
mm-hmm.
and he basically, and this is the week of the Titanic, he basically compares the Titanic itself racing toward disaster with our present system of the rich controlling, being at the levers of power, and racing our own society into disaster, and he particularly references global warming. It's on Nat Geo program, and it's on tonight at 9 o'clock. It's on, and there's a preservation of the Titanic thing on 10 o'clock tonight.
Because that anniversary is fast upon us, is it not?
It is indeed, because the Titanic foundered on the 14th of April and went down and passed from the British Registry at roughly 2:30 or 2:20 on the 15th. And, you know, it's just incredible what the man discusses about the Titanic itself. I mean, I don't want to take up too much time here, but I'll cite two things, the reason that ship went down, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, on the port side of the Titanic was a large corridor called Scotland Road. And it was like on the fourth deck. And the water just flowed right over it. And then the second thing, Lightoller, one of the officers, opened one of the large doors on the left side of the right side of the ship. And the water just flowed right into it. And it was pointed out further, you know, the Titanic, after it struck that iceberg, they proceeded ahead. Did you know that?
Yeah, right.
But, you know, if they, for example, knowing that California was out 607 miles away, could have proceeded astern, which would have minimized the water intake that was already coming into the ship, it would have gotten them closer to some type of rescue. But who would save? I mean, Stanley Lord's operator was not on and didn't hear the distress call, so there it was the fate of the California, the Titanic. I mean, who knows? But it's one of those things of what if, what if, what if.
Right, but it all comes down to human error.
Exactly, and human arrogance of proceeding through an ice field the way we are proceeding today through an ice field. And we are, you know, and the people who are doing this are the ones like the Bruce Ismays, and the owners of the White Star Line, who wanted to make a record break in New York and had that ship going through an ice field at 22.5 knots per hour. That's exactly what we're doing with our society today, with global warming and the use and the misuse of our natural resources and our neglect of the world in which we live.
Indeed. Well said, Jim. I'm going to try to have... Is that the National Geographic Channel?
Yes, sir, it is. And it's a good program. These guys, basically, they're seven or eight. They're with the Department of the Navy, also naval architects and things like that. And these guys are experts on the design of that ship. I mean, it was a beautiful ship, well-designed, but the trouble is it was not handled properly. And it was considered to be the greatest larking, moving thing of its day.
Well, that thing moving at 22 knots, that's no small, that's not small potatoes. That's racing, not cruising.
Well, Bob, I'll tell you, and I'm not trying to take up too much time, if they had not even seen that iceberg and hit it head on, I don't think it would have breached more than two compartments.
It couldn't have done more damage.
No, it couldn't. And, of course, you know, they had no... the Bridgeport Trade didn't provide enough lifeboats. I mean, for the steerage passengers alone, for example, there were only two.
Well, I did catch a little something on some channel last night, Jim, about the Concordia disaster here just a few weeks back.
Oh Lord, have mercy! That can you believe that?
It was a stunning. More than 100 people left on board and no lifeboats.
No, because they couldn't deploy the lifeboats because have you seen the angle of the ship?
Yeah.
I mean, they couldn't do it, and the captain left the ship, and he's been arrested. And, you know, I've heard the tapes of him, you know, of the Coast Guard telling him to get the hell back off that ship. He's a captain.
And he never did.
Mm-mm.
Nope. Jim, a wonderful conversation. Thank you very kindly.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye now. Our good buddy Jim, and moving onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
The education never stops on the Horn.
It really doesn't, David. What's up?
I was going to mention something that what Charles Mann was talking about regarding the Amazon. Are you familiar with a man named Martin Brell?
I guess not.
Martin Brell was the man who swam the Amazon. He also swam the Danube and the Yangtze River in China.
Oh, okay.
And this documentary that I just witnessed this evening is pretty amazing. It talks about the preparation and the trip and what motivated this man. And
when did this happen?
I think he did it in 2007, 2000, somewhere around.
Oh, okay,
there.
So fairly recent.
Right, and the amazing thing about it is he didn't start, get this people, he didn't start swimming rivers until he was 45, number one. Number two, he was completely overweight. And when I mean overweight, he would have been like a character like Jim Belushi would have played him.
Wow.
He looked like, in fact, he looks like exactly uncanny to Jim Belushi.
A question coming in from the chat room. How in the hell did he swim through the Amazon River without getting eaten by something?
Well, here's the amazing thing about this this man. It all starts with the fact that he comes from Slovenia, and in Slovenia he basically built himself up as a reputation. It's kind of like a DIY type of adventurer. He was into gambling. He was into drinking. One little side note, he actually makes his living as a flamenco guitar teacher. And that to me was really surprising, just hearing all the things that make someone want to get in the river in the first place. But I think the most amazing thing about it is his exercise regimen is absolutely unbelievable. Number one, he drinks every day. He drank every day when he was swimming the Amazon, if you can believe that. There's actually a scene where he's in the Amazon. Get this, Bob. there's a scene where he's in the Amazon. He's completely out of his gourd from swimming for, like, I don't know, 25 or 30 days. And he tells his shipmate, give me a bottle of whiskey. And you see him drink a bottle of whiskey, down it. I'm not talking just a sip, people. I'm talking about he was literally drinking the whiskey. Everyone on the ship is like, this guy is absolutely crazy. And he would just continue swimming on. Even drunk out of his mind, he would still continue swimming.
Maybe that's
on.
The key.
Yeah.
And what's his name again?
His name is Martin Brell. But the amazing thing...
What's the name of the film?
Big Man Ripper. Big Man River is the name of the film, and you can probably get it pretty much anywhere. Just look for it on Netflix. But the amazing thing about it is what drove him, and this is part one of the touching parts of the documentary. Is he says what really drove him was the fact that he was beaten every day as a child. And he said that the pain that he went through going through swimming through these rivers is nothing compared to the beatings that he got as a child. And it's kind of like it's complete therapy for him to be in the water. And what's amazing about the film is the reason, and it kind of ties into what you were talking about with Charles Mann, and the reason why he wanted to do this, which this is the other interesting thing I found, is he wanted to bring awareness to the waterways of the world. And he thought, the best way I can do that is if I swim these waterways. And while he's swimming the Amazon, you learn about the various plights, the various cultures, some basic history regarding the areas. And it's really quite amazing to see... For example, there's one part in the documentary where he completely sunburned his face. I mean, we're talking second, third degree burns. And again, ladies and gentlemen, he didn't stop. That's the amazing thing. He didn't stop. And he just kept going, and they said, well, I guess the best thing to do is put like a white mask over your face. So he's swimming in the river, and he looks kind of like he looks kind of like this type of Frankenstein swimming in the river, and he startles the locals. And he finds out that the legend in the area where he currently is that nobody goes in the waterways because of a mythical referenced swimmer creature called a fish taka. And he
and he's it.
Yeah. He decides to go to the side of the village and catch a breather, but the thing is they're not used to seeing a Slavonian man swimming with a white mask on his face. So as soon as he hits the river banks, you see the reaction of like dozens and dozens of people, and they basically tell him he can't stay there because they think he's a demon. So he has to continue swimming on and on. And there are surreal moments, like when he's cordially invited to be in a 5-star hotel during his expedition, and you get to see like the various comparisons and contrasts to the poverty, and then completely being something so posh, you just can't believe it. Like right there on the side of the Amazon, just a complete, you know, megaplex of malls, 5-star hotels, stuff that they would build in Dubai, and you just look at that and you're like, wow. And it's really an amazing film, and there's just lots of things to learn from it. And one of the things that was really interesting was the fact of how much reverence he had for the people there where it was concerned their waterways, and he pointed out various things. They showed the various pollution that was going on. At one time, they were really worried because the Amazon hadn't experienced, and that was part of it too, the Amazon hadn't experienced a lot of rain, so that's one of the reasons why he got sunburned for a few days that was looking pretty grim for him. But it's just an amazing story, and it's almost unbelievable, unreal to think you have somebody who's like 75, 80 pounds, overweight, swimming in the water, drinking whiskey, drinking beer, doing everything you're not supposed to do, and yet going 60 days straight, breaking his world record of over 1,000 miles.
Wow.
And yeah, so if you guys want to check that out, it's called Big Man River, and it's really inspiring, and I won't spoil the ending for you, and it's really interesting just to watch and see. The family business aspect of it, too, is what amazed me. The fact that his son runs the business with him and the way they work the sponsorships and just how crazy this guy is, Bob. I mean, you understand going into it. Like, there has to be a certain element of craziness that drives you in the water. But the fact that it's just the people that are that are attracted to him and are brought in, it's just an amazing ensemble cast of characters and people that come from all walks of life, and no matter what this guy says, they're like, "I'm on your team, Martin, let's go." No matter what. There was one point which I just thought was insane. There was one point where he just, dig this, Bob, he just vanishes completely for a night. A night, ladies and gentlemen, he vanishes for a night. They find out that his navigation friend and Martin, they go in the night with no GPS system, just go trudging down the river. So
nice.
He has to bring the boat out with the floodlights and look for him. Because they don't know what they're going to find. They don't know if they're going to find him dead. They're not going to find him. They're going to find him drowned. They're worried about the pirates. They're worried about everything. That's the other aspect. Too much to get into. The parasites, the fish. Oh, my God. Just one thing after the other. But the fact that he just completely overcame all those odds, and everybody told him, "You can't do this, Martin. You're overweight. You're too old." I think he was 53 years old when he did this, Bob.
Wow, I'm feeling better about myself.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, because it makes me think. And here's the mind-boggling thing. I think people have it wrong about swimmers. You know how they say about swimmers build, swimmers bodies? I think they have it wrong, because in Martin's case, it worked to his benefit, because he had built this mass, this massive weight on him. He was swimming in an area where he would have to eat a certain amount of a diet and drink a certain amount of much, which I wouldn't recommend for a lot of people, and he certainly overdid it. But the fact that he was overweight, it's what's amazing is it allowed him to continue to trudge on, like 10 days, 20 days, 30 days. If you think about, some people wouldn't even be able to make it 5 hours in there, let alone 1 hour.
True. Jug of Punch noting in the chat room, well, you know, fat makes you buoyant.
Yeah, that is true. But, I mean, you look at all the swimmers, and you see how many overweight 53-year-olds.
Yeah, was he wearing one of those highfalutin Nike one-piece, got scales like a fish swimsuits?
That was the amazing thing, too, Bob, because I was like, how the hell... In a wetsuit, he was wearing a wetsuit, and he was like, "How the hell could you wear a wetsuit like that in temperatures like that?" And again, I understand going crazy and all that, but the fact that he didn't go through heat exhaustion and they had to pull him out and take him to the hospital is insane to me. But he had built up this tolerance, I guess, from his years in Slovenia or whatever. I don't know. And just such a character and such an amazing, inspiring story, and the fact that when you have somebody like that swim the waterways, which you probably won't see in a long, long time, he brought a lot of awareness to the areas when he swam the Danube, when he swam Yangtze, when he swam the Amazon River, and he'll never be able to do it again.
No, that's a one-off.
But I'll tell you something. It is something like that. It does.
I'd recommend against him swimming the Mississippi because it's
toxic. Oh, yeah, the Mississippi,
toxic.
Too. He did swim the Mississippi. That's
son of a gun.
That's the one I forgot. Yeah, so it's just amazing when you see the footage. And just, there's footage where he's in Slovenia, and they show part of his regimen of where he swims for 5 hours a day. And they show him, he's like a god in Slovenia, and all these kids are around him, and he's high-fiving all of them. But I think the great thing about it is the fact that he seems so out of place when you see him. And there's a part of it where he's walking in New York, and someone asks him, and he says, why are you, and he's in a Speedo, I kid you not, he's in a Speedo.
Oh. No 53-year-olds in Speedos.
Please. And the guy asks him, he says, so where are you planning to swim, mister? And he's like, oh, I'm going to swim the Amazon. He's like, yeah, right. But he had that kind of cockiness, it was the right chemistry. He had the cockiness, he had the insanity. You just watch his documentary and you can't believe. I sort of wish when they covered this on CNN and the news and all these areas that they covered a bit more about this this guy's backstory and his history, because it's just amazing just watching the fact that someone like that really defied the odds. And when I say he came close, people, oh Jesus, man, when you watch a documentary, you'll just be blown away. You'll be like, I can't fathom this. I can't comprehend this, because there's so many moments where you're like, yep, that right there, that's when I would sink to the bottom.
Well, cool. Big Man River.
Yeah, Big Man River. But before I go, I do want to, I think you should mention the your email so people can reach out for contributions.
Absolutely. Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com.
And one last thing, I looked at my email and I see that Juggle Punch has not sent me an address, so I can't.
No, that's my bad. I owe you that.
Oh, okay. All right, then.
I'm sorry. I thought I had already done that.
Away, Juggle Punch. But I mean,
double check, because I think I did.
What's that?
I think I did send it to you.
Oh, you did. Well, I'm gonna have to check the email to make sure again. And if I don't find it, I will send you a email and to see if you can. Resend it to me.
Okay, because, I mean, I think I did it during Showtime, even.
And now, everybody, light up the phones. The number is 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. See, you don't have to do that now, Bob.
Yeah, 877-443-2366.
All right, have a nice evening.
All right, thank you, David. Take care. Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. Another David in South Carolina, noting that, remember, Olympic champion Michael Phelps, reefer never slowed him down. Maybe swimming is just like this. Could be. Could be. Before I go back to the phones, note from Kate. She says, good job. Wish you'd have stayed for another hour. She says, I'm not as optimistic as you, Albert, Mr. Mann, et al. We're not able to fight an epidemic of a virus or a microbial infection. Marburg and Ebola are a constant threat. There's an antibiotic resistant strain of malaria upon us, not moving around the globe. There is a fungal infestation of grain crops here in the U.S. and moving around the globe at central latitudes. 85% of the global population do not have access to potable water. Millions are starving. The monarch butterflies have lost nesting habitat, the milkweed and their migration routes. The honeybees have to be shipped from state to state every season. Speaking of migration, our racist words come from European invasion. Zombo, a word you'll learn about in 1493, meaning knockmead. Zombo was a Spanish label for mixed race from the 1500s. Kate says, how long did that restaurant last in this country? Sambo's? Yeah. It was renamed and rebranded and repurposed to Denny's, wasn't it? And the culture behind it sort of remained intact. Kate says, sorry for the wandering here, but this subject does that to me. I don't see a bright future. I'm currently reading Collapse by Jared Diamond, and you know, I've read that, and it's a it's the feel good story of the decade. Not, but it's a brilliant book. That and Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Mr. Mann makes reference both to Jared Diamond's work and to Michael Pollan's work in 1493. Kate says maybe I should lighten up my reading list to UFO research. Thanks, Kate. Kim, Speedos and Men. I've seen a few older, well over 60s group in Speedos on the beach this winter. What was scary was when you left the beach and the one man in particular was sitting in his car with his Speedo unit air fluffing on his car mirror. Yeah, LOL, Kim. No, you will not catch me in a Speedo. That's just insane. The belly's bad enough without the... Yeah, sorry. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello there, Bob.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Not much. Out here in sunny, warm Colorado Springs. It feels like maybe June weather out here.
Yeah, and a little droughty out in Colorado as well.
Yeah, just a little. Getting a little dry out here.
Well, don't worry. The fracking industry says they need all your water.
Yeah, I know. It's, you know, I guess this capitalism movement is going to continue right on unabated until they take every ounce and bit of resources out of the earth.
Well, until such time as we make them change.
Yep, that's true. And the question is are we going to do it in time, or are they going to take every resource from us, and then we won't have to make them change? But then again, there won't be anybody here to make them change.
Yeah, you know, they'll hang on just enough of us to work for them.
Yeah. I really enjoyed your interview with Mr. Mann today. I called the Talking Book Library to see if they had it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised. Yeah, they have it. But what even impressed me even more is the woman taking the call knew exactly what I was talking about. So I was very impressed by that. And I also ordered 1493. So I'm looking forward to getting the book and listening to it.
Well, if you take them in series, it will make more sense.
Yeah. And I'm going to have to do that because they haven't put 1493 out yet on DVD. So they're working on it, but they haven't put it out yet.
Okay.
So,
well, 1491 will give you plenty to chew on until 1493 gets to you.
Well, yeah, I feel like I've read the book already based on how much everybody has talked about it on the show. But I want to read it for myself and, you know, glean every last nugget of information I can out of it. You know, I was really struck by, I forget who you were talking about, who it was, but said that sent an email about his teacher in the...
Oh, that was our buddy Mike.
Mike. And I really was struck by the arrogance of the teacher. Oh, there wasn't any history before that. You know, I mean...
Well, if white folks didn't do it, it isn't history.
Exactly.
I mean, exactly. we reserve the shortest month in the year, February, to cover the entirety of black history.
Yep.
Jesus, there are entire college courses at master's degree levels on the variety of and quantity of civilizations that rose and fell in Africa. But no, if white folks didn't make the history, it wasn't history. It's only history once white people meet you.
And that probably is a good reason why that little saying about not learning from history, you're doomed to repeat it, because if you don't know history...
Well, it's not, but then, you know, I've been thinking about that, Kevin, and it's not a matter of being doomed. There are some people who don't mind repeating history because they're thinking about the history that inured to the benefit of the wealthy, and they want to be wealthy some more.
Yep.
Or more wealthy. And thus far, with very few exceptions, there has never been any repercussion for raping peoples or the planet.
Well, sooner or later, that's going to catch up with them because we have an a finite, limited number of resources, and, you know, eventually the people will stand up and take notice. I just question, you know, how soon they're going to do that, and that's what worries me, because I see this weather out here in Colorado, Bob. I've been out here 16 years, and I have never experienced a March like this. I just have never seen weather like this. They're talking about possibility of thunderstorms today and tomorrow, and so our weather pattern's changing about 2 months early.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just amazing to me that the people that are out there don't even want to consider that there might be some nuggets of truth in that global warming theory. And I really don't care what you call it. You can call it global warming, global climate change, global what.
You know, I saw a phrase today, Kevin, that I liked a lot, global chaos.
Bad.
Or global climate chaos.
Yep.
Because ultimately that's what it winds up being. It's chaotic in nature.
Well, take a look at what happened over in Europe during the winter, the storms they had. You know, I just don't... I tend to not even pay attention to those anymore who come out and say there's no such thing, because there's just too much evidence I'm seeing on my own. And the person that says to me, oh, weather has always gone through cycles, yeah, that's true, but I've never seen a cycle like this. I mean, this is just, it's not that we haven't had hot days in March before, but the whole month was hot, with a couple of days of cold weather, you know, 2 and 3 days here and there, but nothing really that broke the pattern, and it's continuing on into April. I'm fixing to hook my air conditioner up. I've got one of those portable ones, and shoot, I didn't even take that thing out of storage last year until June. You know, but here it is, April, first week of April, start of the second week, and, you know, I've got it all ready to go. It's just a matter of setting it up. So, I don't know about these people. I really don't. And it's kind of the same point in 1491, you know, with the river trees that you all were talking about today. You know, for every action, there's another action or reaction.
You know, one of the fascinating things in his introduction of the chapter, the segment of the book on rubber, Kevin, is the fact that, and again, it's one of those things that makes his writing particularly good, because he remarks and brings to light things that we don't think about. At the time that rubber was first brought back to Europe, the white folks looked at it like a cow looks at a new gate, because it came in ball form. And honest to Pete, it's probably a bit of an overstatement, but not much of an overstatement, until that first rubber ball was brought back to Spain, no white European had ever seen anything bounce. Now, I mean, imagine the word in English, Kevin, bounce. You know, Jesus, we've got a fabric softener sheet named after it now. But dropping something and seeing it spring immediately back into the air was, well, you know, the church was quite sure there were demons in it.
Yep.
Meanwhile, the way that they witnessed it was the fact that some ball players from Mesoamerica were kidnapped or coerced or whatever it was the white Europeans did into coming to Spain. And they set up a ball court, just as you can see the ruins of them to this very day throughout Mesoamerica and Central America. It was an ancient game. And devilishly hard. The ball itself was incredibly hard, made of wrapped strips of latex.
Yep.
And it was played by, you could not touch the ball. This was harder than what the rest of the world calls football and we call soccer. Soccer says you can't touch the ball with your hands or your arms, but you can touch it with your feet. Well, in this game, you couldn't touch it with your feet either. The only thing you could touch it with was your head, your elbows, like knees, hips, that kind of thing. And there were hoops on either side of the court, and sloped sides, and if you could dribble the ball up with the parts I've described and put it through the hoop, it was an instant win. Otherwise, points were scored on either end of the ball court by putting it into a goal that was periodically moved.
Yeah.
And it was and when they watched it, these white people were amazed. I mean, their mouths were hanging open, catching flies. But then, of course, they figured out ways to make money out of it.
Yep. What was the game called? Do you remember?
No, it's just called. It wasn't. There was no name of which I am aware.
But I'm familiar with lacrosse, of course, and that's played with a net.
Right, but that's not played necessarily with a rubber ball. That's, at least in its early origins, it was played with a leather ball.
Yeah.
This was something entirely different. Imagine, you know, never mind a world without a tomato or a potato. Imagine a world where nothing bounces.
Well, like you made the point of saying, or you made the point of saying, imagine all the little things that depend on rubber gaskets and things like that.
Right, and that's the scary thing. If one of those bugs finally, and it will eventually get to Asia, as he said, some of the studies note that the entire world rubber crop could be wiped out in a couple of months.
Yep.
And then what happens?
I can't believe nobody is, you know, because things have a nasty way of happening when you least want them to. I can't believe nobody's preparing for that day. Like you said, trying to build something resistant to it, or, you know, do something, make some kind of contingency plan. But apparently they're rowing down there merrily with their boats filled with money and not thinking about the losses that they'll probably put back on the world population to bail them out of. So I don't know. The only thing I can do is get out and participate in the marches with the 99% and continue to purchase this corporate greed, because if we don't, we keep getting more corporate greed. So
indeed, indeed. Well, Kevin, have yourself. I hope you get the air conditioner working in good running order, and we will talk soon.
Well, I'm kind of hoping, Bob, I don't have to use the air conditioner soon, but it looks like probably Wednesday is going to be the day. It's going to be 76. So, thank you, and you have a good evening, Bob.
All right, will do. Take care, Kevin.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. That's our buddy Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Brother Bob.
Brother Albert.
How'd your pork butt turn out?
Oh, man, I tweeted a picture of it, and I haven't emailed it to you yet, but, man, was it yummy. it was meat. I call it meat candy.
that's a good kind of candy. You gotta love that.
On Saturday morning, we ran to the grocery store and got it and rubbed it down, built the fire, put it on there, left it on for about 16 hours. And, I mean, it just flaked away with a fork. I made the hot slaw, and we're still eating on it. And what's even better, we've got hot slaw left over for having on hot dogs, because that's another one of the part of the wonderful things about it. You make hot dogs, and you put the slaw, just the slaw in the hot dog, and you put it on a hot skillet, and you put another hot skillet on it to press it, or on a Foreman grill or whatever, and you sort of grill it a little bit on the outside. Oh, man. I may have to do that when the show's over. How about you?
I don't blame you. I did the pizza route. We figured we'd do the meat here coming up this week. It was rainy and gnarly all weekend. It was not real.
Not conducive to standing around outside with a cold Leinenkugel in one's hand or...
Yeah, it's not. That's exactly it. I want that image, and I want my first one to be that one. You know what I mean? So I'm going to wait. I can wait. I'll wait for the right one. And real quick, I wanted to pass on a website to everybody just to periodically check, or maybe, you know, what have you. It's called hint.fm/wind. That's it. Just hint, hint.fm/wind. And just check that out every now and then, just to see see how the wind map is across the United States. It's actually a quite a beautiful image. It's nearly live in terms of data of the wind, and it shows you where the wind is strongest blowing over the country as we speak. You know, the more we harness that this constant flow of energy, the more we're more like bacteria, you know, bacteria that can live in caves that are completely isolated from everything, and they just use sulfuric gas, and next thing you know, they're making energy. I mean, you know, they're taking what they have available and implementing it and sustaining life. And I think that that's the root cause, that's prime directive number one for being an organism, is to maintain and protect life. You know, so when we have some slack jaws pulling games and running, making dragon heels and doing everything they can, while the kind of energy that website's showing you flowing over us constantly here and there and everywhere, right now it happens to be, you know, kind of flowing up from Texas into Colorado, which would explain some nice warmness. Me, I'm getting it from Canada. I'm sure you guys can see how Canada's blowing right on me. And we have this beautiful sunny day, but ooh, it's chilly out, and I'm going to need my furnace on. You know, and all these things take energy. And, you know, hey, wouldn't it be smart to use the energy that's cooling you off to maybe heat you up? I don't know. Maybe I'm a crazy person thinking like that. But, you know, I'm also the kind of person that thinks that we should have a lifetime earning cap. Nobody should make more money than you would be able to spend in six lifetimes.
Just six?
Just six. I know. But just six. Six lifetimes, that's it. That's all you can get. All right, after that, you're done. You know, and everything goes into...
After that, you're back on beans.
Yeah, well, everything goes into your least favorite charity. You know what I mean? To balance it out. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, pick three attributes, things you hate, you know, and that's where that money would go to. So,
like, yeah, Don Blankenship's seventh lifetime's worth of money would go to the Coal River Mountain Watch.
a little something like that, a little justice. I mean, I know that's a crazy thing to say, too, but we need a lifetime earning cap. There's no reason when you have $200 million, you know, as the executive of Kinko's once licked his lips and chops about, you know, that he can't wait for his next $200 million. Yeah, how do you need that kind of money for? Well, why do you need that much power? Because that's all that kind of money is. That's just power. I mean, goodness gracious, how many delicious meals can you buy in a lifetime? You know, and so if you can pay for all your delicious meals, then, and if you could pay for, you like clean underwear and nice clean socks, all right, you can buy all the socks you want. Here you go. Here's all the underwear you want. What else do you need? I mean, that's what I mean. It gets into this sickness of power and greed, and we really, as a society, need to get away from all that. You know, I mean, I personally don't respect it, and I think, you know, as a whole, we just need to not respect it. You know, it's gluttonous, it's obese, it's hideous and horrendous in every way, shape, and form. You know, look at Donald Trump, just look at that guy. Look at that thing living on his head. What is that? I mean, come on, he has too much money. We shouldn't even have to, I shouldn't have to look at his face more than for 15 seconds if I was looking in the, you know, Guinness Book of World Records for world's biggest assholes. I shouldn't have to look at his face more than once in a lifetime. I mean, that sure should be my right, and yours, and everyone else's.
I couldn't agree more. And by the way, as we were talking, I did check out hint.fm/wind, and it's forward slash, not backslash. But hint.fm/wind, and it only works in Google Chrome. It didn't show up or do what it's supposed to do on Internet Explorer, but on Chrome it is absolutely beautiful. There's this river of wind that's pouring down, yeah, long about where you are from Canada, and just spilling down across the middle of the country and looping across Appalachia and swirling up into New England, and these looping things going on from the Gulf of Mexico down in the southeast. And wow, it's just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. And it always changes. You know, it changes to what the wind is doing. Yeah, so, you know, sometimes it develops these little swirly patterns, like when we were getting those tornadoes the other week. That's what it was kind of doing. You know, it's beautiful, and it's a river of energy. It's constantly raining on us. You know, how do we not take advantage of that? How do we miss such an obvious example that all life forms, you know, that they all, I mean, plants. That's what plants do. We don't even do what plants do. You know what I mean? And, you know, it is actually...
Well, and I find that particularly hilarious, Albert, in light of the war on broccoli that the right wing has initiated. We're not, you know, we're not as smart as broccoli. Broccoli uses the sun and the wind, and the rain, but we don't. Aren't we smart? No.
No. Well, I mean, that's the other thing, you know, when we're done soaking up the minerals that the earth contain, you know, we're left with these toxic pools that I'm sure there are some microbes on this planet that will live happily in, you know, for the next 100,000 years. You know, plants, broccoli doesn't do that. When broccoli dies, it gets bam, boom, 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 compost, and it improves the soil. It puts back everything it gave. You know, I mean, it took. And, you know, it gives it all back. You know, and that's kind of, you know, that's the thing, is we don't live 500 years. What do you need $100 billion for? What the hell are you going to do with $100 billion?
And, you know, I mean, we just got past Easter, and that whole, you know, there's that whole consider the lilies thing, consider the birds of the air, and because of a couple of Horn listeners who have kindly guided me along, I've been watching, just killing a little time here, and I was watching a video of a guy sailing across the Atlantic the other day. And there's a couple of minutes of his boat just being, he was sailing single-handed, and his boat's just being accompanied by these porpoises or dolphins who are just leaping and running right under the surface and leaping again and running under the surface and coming up for air. And honest to God, maybe I'm imposing something anthropomorphically on them that isn't there, but it looks a hell of a lot like they're just having fun.
Brother Bob, just to speak, to add to the Netflix watching queue, the TED Talks, they've put a whole bunch of collections up on Netflix. Definitely, definitely, that's something to watch when, you know, you don't want to see everything dark and gloomy, you know, besides Jersey Shore with David Attenborough narrating. The next best thing is the TED Talks, you know, which have the world's, that has the world's, you know, sharpest minds and, you know, pioneers and so on and so forth. And, you know, there was they have one of the sections is for animals and biodiversity and stuff like that, and there's an excellent little 15-minute, you know, TED Talk regarding sea lions. And you know, this guy's, you know, plight to try to save, you know, these Arctic and Antarctic conditions. You know, you watch that, and this sea lion, you know, I mean, what are they, sea leopard, that's what it was. What are they, you know, 15 feet long, 16 feet long, 2,000 pounds, trying to, he was there for 6 days, and it just brings him penguins, brings it to him. Come on, eat. Why aren't you eating? You gotta eat. Protecting him from others. I mean, amazing. It's all, yeah, just go watch these things. And, yeah, that's what I mean. You know, these animals just live their life doing their thing, see us and interact with us. Yeah, we'll kill it. We're gonna eat it. It's, at one point or another, I mean, goodness gracious, that's what we have supermarkets for. I mean, and that's a whole other thing, I understand, but we really need to be whaling and eating porpoise, and we've all know what the cove is, and that's where that stuff takes me, you know,
yeah.
When I sit there and I see that kind of stuff. Well, and for a minute there, you were going to talk about the, what was that guy who went and took the kayak between Australia to go to New Zealand? That's one of those little touching, moving human stories. But, you know, that's what I mean. That's these people, they develop all this life, but they never live any life. You know what I mean? They got all this money, but they don't live anything. They don't go out and see these things. You know, instead what they do, and now we have the APA. Thank you, EPA. Oh, my God. Did the EPA just come out and criticize some chemical companies for the plight of the bees? Or is that not one of the most important things that we could be talking about right now?
No, they did do that.
They did, and that's a good thing. Oh, my God. So that is an important thing for us to discuss. You know, so now that they come out and say that, now what are they going to do about it? You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I know what
Well, I know. And see, that there's another one of those out there as well, Albert. I don't know if you saw the story about the scientists who popped out and said, by the way, we're certain of it now. A lot of this increased earthquake activity is being caused by, it's man-made, mm-hmm. man-made earthquakes. Mm-hmm. We can do that now, Albert. We can make earthquakes. Oddly enough, it's not gay people making them. It's profiteering fracking bastards and mountaintop removal blasting demolition jackasses doing it.
Yeah, what was it? wasn't it like 8,000, 9,000 just, you know, from the fracking? It was an increase of, you know, 500% or something like that along those lines. You know, in Pennsylvania and these other places, you know, and I don't know about you, but I don't need my drinking tap water being able to set on fire. I don't need that. I don't know. I mean...
No, and you know, it doesn't even have to catch on fire to be toxic. We've got a beautiful well here. We can't drink from it. We've got, instead, a $100 water bill every month. And the same obtains all over Appalachia. We done brung you the city water. Ain't that nice? No, I liked my well. Oh, we're sorry. That done got poisoned. You can't use that no more. But. By the way, Michael has awarded you tonight's toaster.
Oh.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be smart to use the energy that's cooling you off to heat you up? He says, there's a zen-like brilliance to that. No? Toaster!
Thank you. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, that's isn't that how it is? I mean, isn't that how nature works? Isn't that, you know, how... I don't know. Maybe people need to watch more David Attenborough. You know, he's narrating all the time in my head, so, you know, I can definitely recommend it. You know, it's not a bad thing, you know, have David Attenborough as a voice in your head. You know, just narrating, oh, look at this, and oh, isn't that fascinating? You know, all the things that David had, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's one of the...
Has he done Jersey Shore?
You know, in my mind, yes. you just have to hear his voice. You know, you watch the Clever Monkey documentary that he did. That's a very excellent documentary. And then Jersey Shore is like Clever Monkeys too.
You know, somewhere out there, there is somebody who is about to embark on a video project of layering the Clever Monkey audio over Jersey Shore, and it's going to be your fault, Albert.
It has to be done.
These little things we whisper into the universe, we've got to be cognizant of them.
It'll be one of the best things the Internet's ever done to this point, if they do that. I mean, it's brilliant. He needs to do it really, for real. It really is. It's that vital. My children are not quite there yet, but they're getting there. A few more years, maybe.
I remember when a brilliant radio guy in Cincinnati once did a bit in which he suggested that the what was then the Cincinnati Reds broadcast team of Marty Brenneman and Joe Nuxhall could be replaced by a monkey and a dog, and proved it, and it worked. It may have actually been better baseball radio commentary.
Hey,
I mean, you know what it's a long fly ball sounds like in human. Well, it sounds the same in monkey and dog. Right, you know, and when the shortstop boots the easy ground ball,
I'm telling you, it's, you know, it's almost like, did you check that thing from The Onion? I know I'm bugging.
Yeah, I did.
I just.
I was ruined.
How do you not love the Earth from wind power flying off into space?
Well, the funniest thing about that is that it was passed around by the Friends of Cole as reality.
You know, they ruin everything. They ruin water and air and comedy. They're terrible. I can't stand these people. Are you for real?
No, really, they did. I'm not kidding you. The Friends of Cole took that windmills will make Earth fly off in its axis into loose space, onion piece, and said that it was reality. With a real ballyhooed kind of "see, we told you so" approach. Don Blankenship was right all along. All these windmills are going to just zoom us off into space and we'll freeze to death in the cold just like the tree huggers want us to.
Did you really think it was a real time machine? You're stupid. If there's no time machine, how are you going to get any money? Huh?
Huh?
I mean, come on, people. What's wrong with you coal freaks? Get out of them holes in the ground. It's sucking your brains out. I mean, I know. See, That's the thing. That's what's actually one of the funny things about The Onion, is how real they really try to
be. Oh, absolutely. You know, man passionate defender of Constitution that exists only in his own imagination? That's not satire. That's brilliant commentary on reality.
they really, I mean, you know, they've really grown into something I think we all can be proud of. I mean, yeah, they've just been getting better and better and better, and just, yeah, it's like the new National Lampoon's times 100. I mean, it's brilliant, and I love it. And, you know, you just sit there and you watch these things, and, I mean, then you got to show your wife South Park, and she's like, did the Scientologists really believe that?
Yes.
The next thing you know...
And then it's the Mormon episode, and yes...
Yeah, this is what they believe. This is really, really what they
believe.
Yeah, see,
and see, this is so far removed from reality that it's troubling to members of the Horn family. Jim just wrote in and said, "Windmills, are you shitting me?" And no, I'm not kidding. They did. They really, really did, Jim. It's the absolute God's honest truth. And Ray just wrote in and said, "Gladiator." That's the subject line. What Albert does echoes throughout eternity.
Thank you very much. I'm trying. We gotta hit it. We gotta make it go. We're gonna make an echo out there somehow or another. I hope Van's listening today. You know, we definitely need his assistance. Did you, happened to be another one of my favorite topics of conversation. Sir Richard Branson, the guy with the great, you know, April Fool's jokes of going to the center of the earth, but more realistic jokes of going out into space, and, he's part of the Drug Policy Alliance, which we all know, you know, talking about the drug war and so on and so forth. And he apparently was at the White House, and he asked President Obama for a spliff. Of course, in jest, but I find that just hysterical, because we all know that if there is an issue that he is completely, besides race, it's the drug war. And that's the one issue that people keep asking him over and over and over and over and over. End this drug war. This is ridiculous.
Jesus, did you see this photo of the 94-year-old Mexican lady who was strip searched to find that she was carrying a whole bunch of bricks of weed into Nogales, Mexico, wherever, across the border?
Okay, I didn't see the picture.
Yeah, 94 years old. And, you know, the war on drugs caught her. 94. Yeah, because you just know that Granny said, what the children need is I need to strap some bricks of pot to my arms and belly and take it to the grandbabies. No.
Yeah.
You know, she was compelled to do that by somebody who said, you know, you won't get to be a 95-year-old if you don't.
Yeah, or your grandchildren won't be 7. Didn't we learn anything in 1929, 1930?
No, actually we didn't. No, that's booze. God gave us booze.
Yeah, didn't he? I remember that day. And
I remember that day.
I mean, this is where we are, and it's just, you know, this is the beauty of it, is the age we live in. I mean, this age we live in, you know, to sit there and say even back when we first started conversing years back, and to talk about this was still kind of like new information to people. And I hope by now, just me saying the little limited times that I do talk about this issue, I hope that people are sick of hearing about it. I really do. I hope you're sick of hearing about it. I hope you're sick and tired of this situation. I hope, you know, whatever kind of, you know, curtains could be pulled back from your eyes that have been pulled back, you see how, it's not just the cartels, but it's also the prison industrial complex. You see how it's the judges and the lawyers and all these other people, these lobbying groups that just love, right? I mean, heck, Haley Barber has, Iranian nuclear, he's lobbying for them, and these people, I mean, they don't care. They're making money every single situation that they possibly can. For what? I don't really know. You know, because Ali Barber, he ain't got many. I mean, he's got to be on your death pool for the next 5 years, right? At least ten. Haley Barber's in there, ain't he?
How can he not be?
I mean, come on now, look at him. You know, look at him. All right, that's the judge from Pink Floyd: The Wall. Look at him. I mean,
yeah, he needs to go swim the Amazon.
He'd probably do it in 22 days. It's ridiculous. Look at him.
Yeah, email in from Robert noting. Bob, it's the age of stupid. You know, because
that's a good documentary.
Yeah, and well, but that's also where we are. You know, with people who believe that the continents drifted apart 2.5 weeks ago on a Tuesday at 3 in the afternoon. I deluxe toaster. This from Michael again. They ruin water, air, and comedy. And Michael adds, Bob, send him the one that has the special settings for bagels.
Oh, thank you. See, that's what I mean. The other ones I couldn't fit a freaking bagel in. Now this, now I'll be able to have it.
Zircon encrusted, man. Hey, I got to run, Albert. It's a great conversation.
Hey, happy Moran Monday, right? Well, not Moran, not today. We'll do that next week.
Exactly.
Today
was anti Moranity.
Exactly. All right, guys. Talk to you later.
See ya. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Albert, the sage of Southwest Wisconsin. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, listen, so, I was laughing at that. It's not funny, but that Facebook bought that Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the thing is that apparently as soon as they said they were buying it, you got people trying to get the hell off the account. They don't want it. They don't.
Right,
want
because they know they're going to get data mined now for all their worth.
Yeah, but the problem is, what's next? Are they going to buy Twitter? I mean, are there no antitrust laws in operation anymore?
I guess not. I mean,
because it's sort of the way it's looking. Is next thing they'll be trying to buy Twitter. You see what I mean?
Because that's the problem. Isn't Twitter still not making any money?
Well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you look at the sort of grand plan, if I were Facebook, you want to buy up every social media type platform. I mean, this purchase of Instagram, basically what I'm saying is, for me, I just have to get myself ready to revert back to when the internet wasn't so important. You see what I'm saying? Because I can't participate. I think that it's going down a really bad road. I mean, Facebook is kind of horrific. It's not a very nice entity.
No, I don't like it at all. I mean, I hardly even go there. I've got my Twitter account set up so that it posts to Facebook, but I don't go there.
Yeah, well, but it's just, it's disturbing because you have a lot of sort of spinoffs now of smaller social network. I mean, people are sort of recoiling at the size.
Yeah, I'm trying to make myself like LinkedIn, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, I don't know. It just doesn't seem to be a really, I don't know. I was just sort of a bit, aghast. I'm like, oh, my God, so now they're just buying up, market share so they can get themselves together for their IPO. But
well, and ultimately, it's the battle royal against Google, isn't it?
I guess, but I don't even care about that. I find that company disturbing, too. And so, once again, we're looking at trying to use this internet for public discourse when it's owned by private concerns. And you already see what the conflict will be, because I don't really want these entities, using their various algorithms to come up with all sorts of endless profiles to get marketed at. I mean, that's what it comes down to with these companies, whereas we just want to use it to share information and keep track of people and deal with causes or events or whatever, but they're doing something completely different because it's a free service.
And David makes a trenchant observation. David in Tennessee says, asking for any restriction on social media, isn't that like asking a buggy whip Congress to moderate the radio?
Well, yeah, it's just no, but the whole thing is just, it's just not going down a very good road because like I said, Facebook has shown itself to be, a fairly disturbing corporation to me. It seems like it's just going to be a backdoor for, a government plus any corporation who has the money to pay to get at
Well, and it's so pernicious with these stupid little, you know, I get on my little soapbox every now and then, Sandra, about, I mean, Jesus, it's expanded from Farmville into Cityville.
Yeah, no, but...
And Mafia Wars and Castle Defense and every one of those things wants access to everything in your world.
And not only that, but you're already creating free content for them. You see
yeah.
what I'm saying? Just in general. So they're already monetizing that. Anyway, I don't know. I don't mean to bitch about...
No, but it feels a little like being one of those little in utero thingies getting the life energy sucked out of it in the Matrix.
Yeah, I don't... I you know, it's just, you know, when I saw that today, I just thought, oh, what? You know, it just kind of bugged me because it's like... I don't know, you know, where's the antitrust laws, you know? I mean, when does that ever kick in? It's too much. And this other thing that's getting to me, I don't know, what's it, I forgot to write it down, it's like Senate Bill, oh God, what is it? Anyway, it's, you know, courtesy of my senator, Barbara Boxer, you know who she is, right?
Absolutely.
Well, they have some, you know, on some transportation bill or something that they're forever tinkering with, they're going to make it so that if you owe back taxes, you can't get the fuck out of this country.
I saw that. That's creepy as hell.
Well, you know, I think the threshold is at $50,000, but you know how these things are. I mean, you know, what... basically, I can't believe how rapidly it's... In the last year, it's just become a complete... It's turning into just a police state because ever since Occupy, you notice how things have just gone buck is crazy? With the strip thing and now this law where they're, you know, $50,000, I'm sure to end up being, if you owe any back taxes, we're going to take your passport.
And, you know, this all stems... It's an authoritarian streak that pops up, Sandra. I remember when I couldn't, because I didn't know. I was trying to get a copy of my transcript from West Virginia University.
Why, you owed some money?
Oh, no, I had a parking ticket.
Well, see, yeah. No,
the time they told me about the parking ticket that I had, it was a $75, $82 that parking ticket, something like that.
Well, they're now trying to keep people's transcripts away from them. Say if you're trying to, you know, if you're... In default, if you have some issue with your student loans.
Right, then you're not really educated anymore.
Well, no. But the problem with that is, how in the world do you get yourself in? It's like pretty much when they put you in jail for debt. That's the same thing because you're not able to get work to pay back the loan, which is effectively what they're doing if they deny access to your transcript. Because... Not only can you not use it to apply to another school, but sometimes you need you need your transcript when you're applying for a fucking job.
You're here.
And so if you can't get access because you're in default, how in the world do you get the job to pay back the
loan? Yeah, meanwhile, on the other end of that, there's the question of why don't we do something about the student loan debt crisis in this country, but no...
We are. We're going to double the interest rates in the summer.
Yeah, and we're going to double down and make it harder because, you know, that's going to make people who don't have money in the first place pay it back because everybody's just been deadbeaten, right?
Well, not only that, but I mean, I think that applies to new loans. I don't think it applies to the fixed loans that are out there. I don't think they can do that yet.
Don't think they won't. Look what they're doing.
No, but I think this one is, I mean, because I don't know. I suppose some of the loans are adjustable. I really can't figure that one out. I mean, if it's applying to, you know, new loans that are being issued or if they're just going to be doubling everyone's interest. I mean, it is really horrific.
Well, I mean, it'd be hard to re-screw somebody when that interest rate was contractually obligated.
Well, exactly. But once again, though, we're not in the realms of following that anymore. I mean, it seems to be so tiered out. Sometimes.
Yeah, I'm sure objecting to that would be like forcing someone to eat broccoli. Hey, Sandra, I got to get out of here, but
okay.
We'll continue the conversation hopefully in the next day.
All right. Bye.
See ya. Bye. Sandra calling from California. Time to get out of here. Thanks to everybody for joining in. Thanks to everybody who makes all this go. And thanks, of course, to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there, learn about the work. Rick Smith is next, and always, always.